your report.
Hey Jackie. I was even going to put the minutes approval off until
after. Okay, that makes sense. After roll call.
Just want to clear the room.
We're working on that.
Therefore, and there you go.
Okay.
And I racked up a lot of expenses that time. Well,
you got the government aid, right?
Yeah.
We got really lucky on the weather up in Portland.
It's probably gorgeous.
Yeah, it's not like that all the time.
I want to start with.
All right, we'll be getting started here in just a second. We wanted to add some additional seating, so please, if you don't have a place to sit, we have a couple of chairs up front, and we're a little limited, so if you're able to stand, and maybe for people who aren't able to stand for a lengthy period of time, you could surrender your chair, and we'll just make do and maybe open up the doors and add seating if we get a late rush.
There's two up here, and one here, and one there.
So
come on in.
All right. We will begin with the Tuesday, May 1st meeting of the Clark County Historic Preservation Commission. And beginning with roll call and introductions, let's start with the lady here on my left.
Sarah Fox.
Robert Hines.
Alex Gall.
Rock Manley.
Sean Dennison.
Jackie Camp, Clark County.
Sharon Lynn Montgomery, Clark County.
Keith Jones, City of Vancouver.
Jason North, City of Vancouver.
Mark Person, City of Vancouver.
Great. And if you haven't had an opportunity to sign in, maybe you can sign in before you leave this evening. But I think most people did. So we've got a little bit of an unexpected crowd this evening, so we're going to rearrange our agenda a little bit. Can I get a show of hands, please? How many people are here out of interest for the Academy, the request for feedback on the Academy? Okay. And then St. James Catholic Church, a couple of people. Louisville Park, a couple of people. Okay. So I think in the interest of everybody's time, what we'll do is we'll move the Academy forward. So this is a request for feedback on proposal for two new buildings at the site. This is not the official heritage overlay review by the HPC. The applicant is seeking feedback only, so official review for recommendation is yet to be scheduled. In other words, we won't be making any decisions, final decisions or resolutions on the designs or recommendations on it this evening. Basically, we'll be reviewing the plans that Keith is bringing before us and providing comment as from a historic preservation point of view. So with that said, Keith, maybe you can begin.
What about the public comment part of it?
Good point, Sarah. Mm-hmm. Because this is not a formal review or a public hearing, we generally do not take public comment at the time that we will go through this review. If you do have some comments that you really want to get across, we would take those at the end of the meeting this evening. Alternatively, you can always submit your comments to community planning as well via email. All right, so Keith, with that said, I'll turn it over to you and look forward to what you have to say.
Okay, thank you. I'm Keith Jones. I'm a senior planner with the City of Vancouver. So I'm just going to give some background on where this project is as far as the approval process. And again, the reason for the meeting tonight is for the applicant who's putting the plans together to present this to the commission and to gain some feedback. So following this meeting, we're going to gain some feedback. I know they've already done some public involvement themselves, and then they will make whatever adjustments to their plans, and then they're going to submit an official application to the City of Vancouver, and then we'll review that, and we'll set up another meeting with the Historic Preservation Commission. We're thinking we're going to have that at City Hall, and we will allow folks to testify at that point. But right now, there is not an official application submitted. So tonight is really for the applicant to present where they are in their design so far and to get some feedback from the commission tonight. So we're happy that folks are here and here to listen, but that, again, is the purpose of the meeting. So I did prepare a memorandum to kind of go through some of the standards and criteria that apply to the project. Neil, just walk through that very briefly,
sure.
And then we can hear from the applicant. So on the memo that I prepared, it stated April 20th. Starting kind of at the bottom here of the page, there's five standards, and those come from the city's heritage overlay. It's in the development and zoning code of the City of Vancouver, and the academy site is in the heritage overlay, and that's where the commission gets. And I want to back up and just make sure it's clear that the commission is a recommendation body per our code to city staff. So they're going to make recommendations that we're going to consider in our decisions. I want that to be clear as well. But it's in this overlay, and that's where we get these standards. And so I just want to walk through those just very, very briefly. They're not going to be up on the PowerPoint. And before that, we're going to jump in. So the first is there's height restrictions, and those height restrictions apply to the front of the building. And those are basically there's a schematic in the code, and it just basically says that you can't build in the front of the building. The front of the building faces Evergreen, and that's traditionally the front of the Academy building when it was constructed, as it faces the Columbia River. The next provisions are they want a couple of view corridors into the site, so on C Street.
Keith?
Yes.
Not to interrupt, but... Okay. There's also height restrictions on the rest of the site, too. It's 75 feet, right?
Yeah, there's a no-build height restriction in the front. Mm-hmm. And then there are height restrictions around the entire property to build.
Just double check.
The next standard is talking about the materials. And it's actually asking that the buildings that are built next to it are composed of brick, that are substantially similar to the brick of the Academy. And that's really some feedback staff would like to get from the commission, because in general, usually new construction is supposed to not look like the existing building, and that's part of, I think, the conversation I'd like to kind of have or get some feedback on as well. And then, again, there's more provisions about not building in the front of the building. Some discussion about sign restrictions, which really apply just to the existing historic structure. And then there are review criteria in the code. Part of that is, and I want to be very clear that this is review criteria. So standards are what they have to be met. You have a setback, it's 15 feet. You have to meet the setback 15 feet. Review criteria are more discretionary, so we're going to talk in terms of how they can be subjective. So this is kind of part of where the applicant is going to make their case about why they decided what they did and how they have prepared their application and what they're going to present tonight. So that's really the staff presentation, so I want to turn it back over to the applicant to present the project.
Okay, I'll just come up here so I'm on my back to folks. But thank you very much, by the way, and thank you, Commission members, for having us here today. And thank you for all the members of the public here that are very passionate about the Academy project. And my name is Mike True, President of the Historic Trust. And frankly, I think the feedback that we get about this project is great in the way that it really reflects the passion for the Providence Academy and the preservation for the Providence Academy. In the end, from the Historic Trust perspective, as an independent nonprofit organization, our goal is the preservation of the Providence Academy building. We had the privilege of acquiring the Academy building in 2015 through a philanthropic campaign, and we've worked very hard for the preservation of the Academy, and just frankly completed about a $2 million renovation of the roof of the Academy, and look forward to future renovations of that building as well. As part of that acquisition, we also acquired some of the property on the northern side of the property and the western side of the property from the Hidden family under essentially kind of a separate contract and a separate agreement where there's a note back to the Hidden family for that acquisition. And part of that is to influence the improvements of that site in a way that really complements and activates the Academy in that property. The Historic Trust has worked for about 3-4 years, frankly, with the development community, with many conversations as it relates to how that property could be improved, to A, retire the debt that exists with the note back to the sellers on that property, and B, how it activates and complements the Providence Academy building and brings activation to the Providence Academy building. Through all that and through essentially the Historic Trust vision and mission with the Academy, the Historic Trust adopted a series of guiding principles, and you may have seen some of this in the public. These guiding principles, in a way, are really a filter for how the Historic Trust has worked through, whether it's the renovation of the Academy and seismic improvements to the roof structure, future ADA improvements to the building, or even the development on the site, or hopefully long-term preservation of the smokestack and other buildings. But those guiding principles really speak to historic preservation as being the primary influencer here. Compatibility, any new construction or alterations are compatible with these sites in the Providence Academy building. Frankly, no matter what takes place, it has to be financially sustainable. Safety and code compliance. Obviously, when the Academy was built from 1871 to 1873, it met all code compliance and safety elements at that point in time. It doesn't exactly meet all of our safety and code compliance today. And while there aren't necessarily requirements for upgrade, we're making a lot of elective upgrades. Two, because we see that building as being a public building with a lot of public engagement and activation. And then the last but not least is stakeholder feedback and public engagement. We see ourselves as stewards of this property and this building, and frankly, this building needs about $15 million of long-term preservation investment. And some of the development on the site is a tool to that and a tool to the activation and enhancement of the Providence Academy. The trust as an organization is made up of a governing body of volunteer board members, also as a volunteer properties committee that frankly has worked through a multi-year selection process and negotiation process with frankly a series of developers. And developers that have looked at the site and want to build 8 and 10 story buildings because current code allows you to build up to 200 feet on the site. All the way to developers who want to build structures where the current El Presidente property exists. And frankly, I think we've landed on an agreement with a developer, Marathon Acquisition and Development, and you'll meet Aaron here in a second, who shares our vision for how we keep the Academy as the focal point of this property and how we preserve the Academy long-term and frankly, long-term sustain the Academy so that frankly, the Academy doesn't turn into what the laundry boiler building is today and demolition by neglect. And so how do we position the Academy for the most successful future so that the 65 tenants that operate businesses there today can continue to operate and we can continue to enhance that building through the public programming, the programming and the events and activities. So I would say that I'm appreciative of our agreement with Marathon. We're in that phase of going through planning and obviously we've gone through the stakeholder process of interviewing our neighbors and stakeholder feedback. Having an open house, online comment, I thank you for those of you that have submitted online comment for this project, and then kind of that last part of the public engagement is really hearing very specifically from the Historic Preservation Commission on what are the different elements to this project as you see the current renderings today that you think the design team should consider in this project going forward. With the goal of, we've assembled an advisory team of folks in the community that will review all of this feedback We'll really go through and analyze the different elements that are feasible, not feasible. Look at that feedback from the perspective of how does that match up against the guiding principles, and in the end make a recommendation to the developer, and here's all the changes that need to take place. And I just want to say that, you know, the Historic Trust is incredibly sensitive to the effects that this property has and the Academy has on our community. Parking is a big issue. There's significant issues around, you know, several acres of that site of parking is unimproved parking surface. That there's a development agreement with the city that requires that to be addressed and changed, or it has to be ceased to be used for parking, period, or upgraded. And frankly, there's not the resources today to upgrade that parking. So we're motivated to see something happen with that site, and in the end, this is all about how do we activate and how do we preserve the Providence Academy, because the stories of the Providence Academy, it's not just the building in itself, it's the stories and the work of Mother Joseph. It's Providence Academy as a school, as the beginning of Providence Health Systems, as an orphanage, and what Providence Academy did for the region that we're most concerned about preserving, and obviously preserving that structure is a tool to do so. So with that, I'll pass it on to Aaron, and he will jump in and give you some more specifics. And really the goal tonight is how do we get as constructive and useful feedback as possible from the commission that we can put into action, and for essentially the advisory team to review and make specific recommendations on changes. So thank you. In the end, the goal is to be able to bring back to the city and the community through a formal process and updated design that would then go through the formal review and comment. So thank you. Eric?
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Aaron Weigott from Marathon Development. We're the developer that's involved in this project. We're really excited about it. Before I get started, I'm going to call up Gene and John, two members of our design team, so they can chime in as necessary. You guys want to join me? Okay. So to start, this site is very exciting to us. It really provides an opportunity to hopefully preserve the Academy. So one of our primary goals in this is to create an economic engine, so to speak, that will help preserve the Academy, pay off existing debt for purchase of the Academy, and then generate more proceeds essentially from the land sale to help renovate the Academy. So that was what was most interesting to us, is that through creating this development, we're helping preserve the Academy. So this is a presentation that I would normally spend an hour or two giving. We don't have that kind of time, so I'm going to skip through the presentation that's in front of you that was provided to you in advance and just kind of give you some highlights, because the goal really is to get your feedback on what we've already done. But I want to give you kind of a 20,000-foot understanding of how the design came to be. So to start, I'm going to give you a quick overview of what the development is as it stands. This is the site plan. You can see two buildings along C Street on the western portion of the site, southern building A, northern building B. The southern building is obviously the smaller of the two. They're five-story buildings. Ground floor of the southern building will be retail, which will hopefully activate Evergreen and C Street, which are very deactivated at the moment. About 6,000 square foot of retail and ground floor amenities for the tenants. So residential above that, ground floor retail with fitness center, bike parking, lobbies, bike washes, all those amenities that tenants now desire. So that in addition to ground floor retail. Building B will have roughly 6,000 ground floor square feet of office space, a few ground floor apartments, and then again tenant amenities for those buildings tenants. As you can see, we set back Building A from Evergreen to create a public plaza of roughly 3,200 square foot on the corner of C Street and Evergreen. We are really hopeful that that will activate the site, will become part of the retail space, so cafe or restaurant space, that people outside eating, enjoying that space, and it will also hopefully be a pedestrian gateway into the site. So that open plaza we found would be critical to activating the site. So that's the rough site plan. I'll tell you, 155,000 gross square feet. On Building A, we will have a rooftop terrace of roughly 4,000 feet. And I could go on and on and on about the details of the building or the statistics of the development, but since we're here to talk about design, I'll get into that.
While you're doing that, Aaron, I'll just point out, one of the most key features of this site today, one of the last remaining historic elements of the landscape, is that heart in front of the Academy. And so the preservation of that part is of utmost importance. And the removal of the El Presidente restaurant building that was built in the 70s, the removal of that and reconnection with Evergreen and the library and activate that public space is part of the goal here. And this development helps actually with that whole economics of that removal.
Yeah, and you'll see that kind of come to light with some of these renderings and further plans. But yeah, there's, again, that public plaza, going to create a public plaza closer to the Academy building, but essentially where that El Presidente building is now. And then just revamping that landscape and tying it all together so it's really an inviting gateway from Evergreen. So really activate C Street with businesses that are people coming and going, and then take Evergreen and really make it a showplace of the Academy and bring people in and out of the site, into the Academy and out of the Academy. So I'm going to go really quickly here through some of this. So to create a mixed-use urban campus, again, we wanted this to be a vibrant center of activity. With this many uses on one site, you really can make that happen. We have residential, office, and retail in the new buildings. The existing Academy building, we will have office, event space, museum space open to the public. So it really has the opportunity to bring in all kinds of different people for different reasons into one site, which will really make it vibrant. So the Academy being a restored landmark and public museum. Aegis is the name that we've come up with for the new developments. It'll be a mixed-use urban development representing guardianship of the community. We thought this was a nod to the history and to the sisters. So I'm going to kind of skip forward to the design because that's what we were talking about. So we had two, in addition to the guiding principles that the Academy or the Trust formed, and of course the code and the heritage overlay and all the other guidelines that we need to follow, we created two guidelines to guide us in the design. One is essentially a 20,000-foot guideline, preservation and possibility, give a historic site new life while embracing its architecture, spirit, and history. So this is kind of a model that we constantly came back to make sure that we were adhering to. So giving the historic site a new life, mixed-use urban campus really will do that. If you go out there now, it's quite a blighted site that needs to be activated. It's really something that can be turned into a campus of several different uses. And then always looking at the architecture, spirit, and history, and whether or not we're creating a compatible, cohesive site as a whole. That's 20,000 foot, more in the weeds, ground level. Compatibility, create compatible juxtaposition of old and new. So this is really where we focused our design and thought. Don't recreate the Academy. You can't mimic the Academy. So compatible but contrast. Create juxtaposition between the two buildings. And how do we do that? We employ current design to accommodate modern needs while incorporating traditional elements showcasing the Academy's inspired history. So we kept coming back to this phrase and breaking it down. So employ current design to accommodate modern needs. A good example of that is large windows. You have to put in big windows now in modern buildings. It just needs to be done. Tenants don't rent buildings unless there's as much glass as you possibly can create. So there's no way to recreate the size of the Academy windows. We had to employ some current design like modern windows to accommodate those modern needs. There's a bunch of other examples of that that really has to some degree be incorporated into these buildings for them to be economically viable and function in today's world. So second half of this sentence, while incorporating traditional elements and showcasing the Academy. So there's a long list of traditional architectural elements from the Academy that we built into our new buildings. They might be subtle. You might not see them at a rendering from a long distance, but there's a lot of them there. The buildings are 80% brick. I'll list off a few, and then we can kind of get into it, depending on how much time we have. Bricks. The buildings are 80% brick. So flat, clean facades is one. Well, I should say, come back to more traditional elements. Soldier courses. So there's soldier courses above the windows in the Academy. There's sills in the Academy. We built that into above and below the windows of this building. So a more modern building would have no soldier courses. So we have all kinds of soldier courses and brick details, pilasters throughout the building to make it more traditional, make it connect more with the Academy. The red brick, the earth tones. So everybody saw in the Columbia the white stark massing that came from the pre-application meeting. These earth tones connect the two sites or the two buildings with the landscaping in between. So elements like that really connect the two. And then when you get to showcasing, this is the last piece of this, showcasing the Academy's inspired history. So how do we make sure that the Academy is the focal point? And we constantly came back to this because it's easier said than done when we're building buildings like these. So, you know, most of this is Gene's credit, but clean, simple lines. So we didn't want to create buildings that had lots of articulation, lots of balconies, too much depth. We just wanted to keep the building simple so that the Academy is the focus rather than the new buildings being too busy and detracting from the Academy. So, and we can get into more of that, but the idea was not to detract from the Academy. Again, easier said than done, but by creating simple lines of a building, not too much articulation, we thought that would be the best way to showcase the Academy. There's also lots of discussion about incorporating red brick throughout these buildings, and there is, you'll see in some other renderings, red brick on the base and up some of the facades. But the more red brick we felt would take away from the Academy and essentially just be a sea of red brick. So there's a lot of debate about that as well. So, and feel free to chime in if you have questions as we go, because we're really here to get your feedback. But I'm going to skip through a lot of this and get to some of the architectural and traditional elements that we built into this into the site. So first, view corridors. The Heritage Overlay has specific view corridors. Preserve the view corridor along Evergreen. One of the big elements of that is revamping the landscaping. Eliminating the El Presidente building will be monumental. Putting in plazas, things to bring people into the site. But preserving that view along Evergreen. And that's this portion here, you can see. So preserving this view corridor from Evergreen. The other view corridor is from C Street. Obviously not as good of a view corridor as Evergreen, but complying with the historic, the heritage overlay, and providing some views of the Academy as you go up and down C Street. And then view corridors from the north along 12th Street south into the site. So these, you can see some of the view corridors, you know, preserving everything along Evergreen so you get a good look at the Academy, setting back the southern building to ensure that that view corridor is preserved and that it's activating the corner. This is the view corridor from C Street, so you get to see the Academy through the two new buildings. And this is a good example of why we only wanted to carry so much red brick up the buildings, because it really frames the Academy. If these two buildings were red brick there, the Academy would essentially disappear behind the buildings. Okay, so some other elements, purposely setting them back, both of them building back, set back, just from, an inviting sense, if our building was up and the new buildings were up against Evergreen, it just wouldn't feel right. So setting it back, in new modern buildings, we would pretty much put right up on the frontage on every occasion, but here, setting it back so that the entrance of both buildings is set back and feels similar. Preserving the heart-shaped walk, you know, ensuring that we have hardscape and landscape invitation into these sites, rather than just being right off the sidewalk. You have a plaza, you have the heart-shaped walk, and you have landscaping mixed in with both. Cohesive landscape improvements obviously make a monumental difference for the site and help tie it together. The earth tones I kind of mentioned to some degree, that we felt was critical. There was a lot of discussion whether we should create more stark contrast between the two to really have the Academy stand out, but in the end, we thought that essentially using the same tones for both buildings and the landscaping would help tie it all together. Red brick into the hardscape, so we're going to try and reuse the historical brick from the restaurant building and build it into the plazas on both sites, build it into the walkways, build it into the landscaping elements as much as we can. I should also mention that's in an earlier part. We're going to have lots of historical interpretive art. So both informative interpretive art that provides specific information about the history of the site, and then things that are more abstract throughout the site. But that's going to be a critical component that I think will tie it together, not necessarily architecturally, but historically. The clean lines that frame the Academy. So this is something that we debated greatly, is how simple do we make the facades of these buildings? How clean do we make them? And will lots of articulation, lots of balconies, and lots of essentially busyness that sometimes you'll see in buildings today, which is often driven by the interior use of the buildings, how much would that detract from the Academy? And is the right thing to do is to keep it simple, clean lines? So this is a good example. They're pretty simple facades along C Street. So on both sides, they're pretty simple, clean, and not too busy. Mostly brick cladding. So we've had a lot of comments from the public about the concrete doesn't work. So on these renderings, that brown brick is being read as concrete. But when you look closely, and you obviously can't see here, that's all brick. So there's a few elements of concrete panels like these, which represent about 15% of the facade of the buildings, the elevations, but 80-85% of the building is brick. So, and whether more of it should be red brick, we'd love to hear from you, but we really felt that the brown brick allowed you to see the academy without creating too much distraction. So this is an example of some of the soldier courses. This is not stuff that we would typically do, but more traditional elements, pulling the columns out, creating soldier courses above and below the windows. Again, all traditional elements. Then, you can see here, too, soldier courses above and below, and you can see some of the soldier courses built into the academy site, the sills and the windows. Not always built into buildings, but we're trying to recreate that.
While you have that comparison right there, that's what struck me the most about your building. When you say windows, lots of windows are great, but the profile of the academy windows, they've got a rounded top, they have squares, panes versus rectangular panes. So it seems as if even though you don't need to mock up a version that's, you're at a very initial design point still, to be that specific, but those are things I was thinking could be closer to tie the whole design together between the two structures would be even something as showing the windows being square, square panes having some rounded features or something along those lines. Just since that's such a good map, picture, I don't want to stop your entire presentation.
No, that's fine. That's why we're here. So the more the better, please. We talked about round. The reality is it's really difficult to have windows this big with an arch on the top and this frequent throughout the building. It's one, cost prohibitive, and two, for windows that wide, you end up with a really large arch, which is difficult to do. The panes, that's an interesting point that actually wasn't considered. My concern with that is the experience for the tenant on the inside of the building. How much are we restricting the light and their views, and how feasible is it to get panes like that? But that's a good idea. So we'll look at that. And just so you know, we've had a lot of feedback from the public that's similar to that. It's a long list that we are going to go over on Thursday with this advisory team that we put together that are not only all of us there kind of discussing the issues, but they're third-party professionals, members of the community, architects, interior designers, developers that are going to help us work through these issues and what's appropriate, what's viable, what's not, and then come back to you with these changes. So, but that's a good one. That's not on the list. So now it is.
And I'm wondering if perhaps with the arches, in fact, we can't use arches everywhere, if there was a nod to the arch at some point in the building, whether it's at an entrance or something, if that would help to...
Like at the bottom floor and the
top
floor.
So stitch together.
Like,
and then the whole idea is to stitch together this story, both architecturally as well as historically.
Right.
And so these nods back and forth, that might be something to consider, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's been discussed too with the gables, is incorporating the pitch of the roof in other elements of the building rather than the roof itself. That's on the list. And putting the arch, there's no reason why it can't be done anywhere, but to do it on hundreds of windows is probably impractical, the arch.
And
the panes is a little bit different. And the other thing, too, is that it's really hard to... Buildings on this scale are really hard to imagine from the pedestrian perspective. There's renderings in here that are bird's-eye perspective to show the whole site. But the reality is, when you're down on the ground floor, that's just not what you feel. So what we really need to try and do is figure out what it's going to feel like as a pedestrian. Again, because you might see these buildings from a quarter mile up C Street, but the reality is the vast majority of the people are going to experience the buildings from the pedestrian perspective. And so some of these things, on the top floor, whether this is an arch or not, is never going to be perceived from the tenants or from the ground floor pedestrians, I don't think. But so doing things more on the ground floor that ties it together is we focused on some of that stuff. But it's a good idea.
And even from the ground floor perspective, what I noticed would be in the plaza, the landscaping someday is going to mature, mm-hmm. and someday should match that of the academy. Mm-hmm. And so just looking at the tree wells look mm-hmm. just like the standard detail for tree wells anywhere in the city of Vancouver, I'm sure that's not going to fit a mature large tree. So planning in to have that landscaping someday be more seamless would be something I'd shoot for too.
Well, so the goal is to make all the landscaping seamless by essentially revamping the landscaping in the front of the academy as well. Some of that is governed by city standards of what trees you can put out there and what you can't.
But on that private side, that is your...
Sure, oh yeah, there we can pretty much do what we want, yes. And to be honest, the specific vegetation has...
Right, I know you haven't gotten there yet, but I'm just, as you're establishing some of those...
Mm-hmm. Yep, yes. So the more the better. So in just some other elements, debate whether we should weave this as exposed concrete, but we came to the conclusion that it matches, the limestone and concrete that's built into the academy. There's been a lot of discussion about balconies, so the more feedback you have on that front, the better. That's always a complicated issue. Just some examples of some more brick courses. Windows. So the rhythm and the symmetry of windows. There's a lot of buildings we would build now where the windows aren't necessarily stacked or they aren't necessarily symmetrical. So the windows in the academy are pretty well stacked and symmetrical, so we tried to mimic that as best we could. So none of the windows are out of stack, and they're somewhat symmetrical. It varies a little bit here and there, but we felt that that was important. The base of the buildings, making sure they're both anchored. I mean, the academy has a stone base. Most people don't perceive that, but it really anchors the building. So doing a dark red brick base, we felt anchored the building. There's been discussions of doing a different type of stem wall along the bottom to tie those two a little bit closer together. But recreating stone like that is very difficult to make look right without just being too faux. There's a lot more to talk about. So articulation, you need some articulation in these buildings so they don't look just like a giant box. You don't necessarily get this from the renderings, but these changes in materials provide you some relief, which just makes the building feel better. Where, again, we started with the idea that we don't want a lot of articulation, so we use materials for the most part to create some articulation. There is some occasions where the building is stepping back, so these balconies are only partially set out from the building, they're partially in the building, so that is creating some depth change, but you don't perceive it as much because the balconies are in front of them. And then where the red brick is, there's some depth relief as well. So the red brick on the upper facades, this was discussed at length, of how much red brick should we really incorporate into these buildings. So we felt that, again, to create some contrast and let the academy really stand out, we should use brown brick for the most part on the upper facades, but carry some of the red brick up so it's tied together. And again, from the pedestrian perspective, you probably feel like you're surrounded by red brick with the base of our new buildings and the academy, but from a distance, you'll see the academy because it's not set against all red brick on the upper floors. But that's, obviously open for discussion. Again, here's some more just neutral colors. So carrying red brick up here was discussed. But again, to try and make the academy stand out from the corner of Evergreen and C Street, we went with neutral colors. So I don't know how much time I don't want to take too much time. So it's really the intent is your feedback. And really, the more you can give, the better, because this is the opportunity to make this as efficient as possible. We'll be in front of you again, but I want to come back in front of you, hopefully with some changes based on your comments and the public's comments. So we're just further along in the process when we're going through the formal design review submission. And for the public that's here, it's not going to get an opportunity to speak, submit comments. If you haven't already, the Historic Trust website has a page dedicated to this that welcomes comments. So that would be the place if you want to provide comments sooner rather than later.
So, and I would like to say, just for the public's knowledge, Mike and the Historic Trust have been very proactive in reaching out to the HPC throughout this process. We toured the site when this project was much earlier in its stages last summer, and so we have been involved and we intend to stay involved. So thank you, Mike. Maybe what we can do in the interest of the time is we'll just go around and can ask each of the commissioners to, kind of condense their thoughts into, 3-4 minutes if you have some comments that you would like to make here for the record this evening. And maybe I'll start with you, Sean.
I have a question. I think this one is for Mike. So I'm curious, why sell off part of the land instead of selling the undeveloped potential of the land?
Can you specify what you mean by that, the undeveloped potential?
So the Heritage District Overlay has given you one of the most powerful preservation tools that exists in this country, which is instead of developing on this land, you can actually take the development potential, sell it to another piece of property, and then they can build a larger building than they would have otherwise. It's, this goes right back to the roots of the formal preservation movement in this country. It allows owners of historic properties like these sites that are under development pressure to raise capital, to raise revenue, but actually preserve their site even more than they would have otherwise, because once that development potential is sold to another site, it can't be built on. And so the site is protected and the owner gets revenue. So, I mean, this doesn't exist in a lot of places. It's truly one of the most powerful preservation tools we have. So I'm curious why you didn't pursue that, why you're pursuing dividing the site and developing on part of it.
I would say a big piece of that is activation. How do you activate that site? And adding some of that density helps really activate that site, and it really activates that preservation of the gateway into the historic site, as well as the connection from the historic site into the academy site. So, I would say the site, the Historic Trust Board has been very open in all the different cases, and frankly has researched many different case studies associated with this. But that, the activation piece is just as important as the financial component of this.
Okay. Did you even pursue that?
It wasn't pursued as a heavy priority for this site.
All right. Well, I'll try to get 3 or 4 minutes.
Design.
I wrote them down so I could be fast.
Stick to design.
So I'm going to stick to design.
Yes.
So I think, I think the first issue actually goes right to that, which is scale. Which is, we are looking at buildings that, it's the first criteria given in the ordinance for establishing compatibility. And these proposed buildings are huge blocks, all mass, pushed to the edges, pushed to the height limit of the site. They project beyond even their own footprints. Because of this, the proposed buildings would actually, I think, deactivate the academy part of the site. They would create a spatial barrier between the academy and the rest downtown. They are so large on this site, massively spatially large, that they actually pull the focus off of the academy and become the primary building on the site. The renderings, I've noticed, one of the things about architecture school, you learn that you can learn a lot from a building, from a design by what's not shown. The renderings have been chosen to diminish, I think, and to really minimize the impact of this discrepancy in scale. But even in the renderings, it's pretty substantial. I think the issues of architecture and design, it goes beyond just materials. It's about massing and character as well. I mean, when you look at what the academy is, it is articulated, and yeah, you can choose to be juxtaposed to that, but it also provides complexity in its perspective as opposed to just a big box. I think this issue of it being these buildings, I don't really think they create a gateway to this site. If you think about the view sheds, I'm trying. So when you move down Evergreen, you won't even see the academy, until you get into Evergreen or so. If you look at the site, it's pretty clear. It's a perspective that we haven't seen, which means that from downtown, you have a large mass between the downtown market and the academy. I think also, when you look at C Street, you would have this large building, you have the library, you have the large cinema. They actually create a harder of an edge to downtown. with nothing of consequence behind them. And what you've created here is placing the academy into the nothing of consequence zone. And that view shed from C Street, while it technically meets the letter of the ordinance, it really doesn't meet the spirit, because it's meant to preserve that secondary facade. So there are three most important view sheds into the site. The front, coming down Evergreen, where right now the academy rises above the one-story commercial district, and then the secondary facade. So two of the most important view sheds are gone under this. And the... Well, you know, I think that this is pretty important. So, you know, when it comes to heritage and when it comes to preservation, prominence and visibility is a really critical issue. And that's one of the things that we see here, is that this building is formal architecture. Mother Joseph built it as formal architecture. And one part of the significance is that it's formal architecture devoted to the needy and the poor, not the wealthy. And so part of that formal character of this building is that it's a landmark in a landscape. With this, it's no longer a landmark in a landscape. It's a building in a streetscape behind a bigger building. So this fundamental aspect of its architectural character is gone. And I think there's, you know, these things are going to have an impact on the access to heritage, because that gateway between the buildings isn't really a gateway. That south-facing building really blocks the view sheds, so only someone who's driving is probably going to see it. And that's going to have an impact on telling Mother Joseph's story. If you create this hard urban barrier between most of downtown and the academy, and then there's another hard urban barrier between the academy and Fort Vancouver, it makes it difficult to draw people into the site, even with some retail, because when we look at the new developments that we're getting in downtown, you know, there's going to be a lot of competition for retail space. And I think the last thing that I'd like to say is that I think there is a bit of a thematic issue, because this building, its nature is as something dedicated to the needy and the poor. And I understand that redevelopment is going to take a different set of people, but I think dividing this site, you know, especially when the unity of the site is one of its historically significant characteristics. Mother Joseph had to join four lots together. She had to fight against the city council before she could even buy this thing. She could even build this thing. And so to divide the site and sell off part of it, you know, really has an impact on that historically significant element of the site. And, you know, I ended up not reading my notes at all, so I hope I carried hit all my points.
You can always submit them.
I can always submit them.
But well said. Rock.
Well, I don't have four pages of notes, although some of the things that Sean has said resonate with me to some degree, but on a much less strident, I'd say, format, and I'll keep my comments fairly brief and just focus on some of the, you know, given that I think what I'm seeing, you are in compliance with the code, so however we feel about appropriateness of this structure as a gateway or a barrier between downtown and everything that the academy symbolizes, saying it is what it is, and notwithstanding anything Sean has said, because I do agree with much of what Sean says, light.
This is intended to be feedback at this point. We're not making decisions.
So some more specific things. Say this, the C Street view corridor. The images that are presented and the site plan that's presented, I would suggest considering that there is parking in that view corridor, and we've got this very, very limited glimpse of the academy, where all we're seeing is the back side, the wall of the academy, and some parking. And you talked about interpretive art. That might be a nice area to consider handling it a little bit more sensitively, maybe introducing some kind of interpretive art at a scale that works with the Academy and can be seen from this view corridor. The other view, prescribed view area, is along Evergreen, and the ordinance states from C Street to, I think it says I-5, but I was focusing on C Street because as nice as, I tried to figure out when the Century House restaurant building appeared there, and I couldn't, someone here knows,
something.
I'm sure, 70-something, and it's like, why? You know, why was that ever there? So, hooray, as far as getting
right,
rid of
that. We thought that would be enough.
Opening
well, it's
up
over
that.
50 years old, we should be.
We should be looking at that. But opening that area up and bringing that, you know, formality back to the front of the Providence House is great. Although, you know, bending again to Sean's comments, my first reaction to the perspectives was, well, these buildings kind of loom over the Academy. They do have a heavier presence. And thinking specifically about that Evergreen Boulevard sequence of views you'll see as you proceed east from C Street, they're not only are they looming quite large, you know, we have no stepping of the buildings, no scale, but they actually cut that view off as you enter C Street from what I see on the site plan. Mm-hmm. So that was a little bit of a discomfort for me. I like, you know, getting to more banal things. I like the use of the brick. You mentioned the base on the Academy building. You could probably consider a precast concrete base on the new building, but you know, I know there's a price ticket to that. Precast sills to match the sills on the Academy. Kind of pick up some of those minor details. I understand, you know, the Academy was built in, Sean?
1878.
When, and it's a masonry building, so of course there are arched top windows. That's how you build window openings in a masonry building in 1873. So I don't expect to see arched top windows in a building that's built in 2018 or 2019. But to Sarah's point, the patterns of the mullions in the windows, there are probably some subtleties that could be picked up there that would be very supportive of the Academy.
Also not using a soldier course over a window, which, I mean, it wouldn't have ever happened in a historic building. So soldier courses are great, but...
<What a class. laughs> but so you get the idea with that. I was curious about the color pattern. I kind of like the red with the Milwaukee cream kind of a brick. It's a nice look, and it does sort of kind of pick up the colors of the historic reserve, I think. Is that kind of the intent?
It's more to play off of the Academy than the historic reserve and the earth tones.
Do they all tie in, or is that my imagination?
I would say not necessarily
not so much
with the historic side in Officers Row as much as, you know, the porches and the more the lighter colors on the Academy.
Yeah, okay.
It is very close to the porch colors that exist on Officers Row, which is very consistent with the Academy, though.
Right.
A lot of buildings on Officers Row, that's a lot more of a gray in color.
Okay.
It does tie a little bit to the library across the street, is taken into consideration with some of these.
Right, yeah, the terracotta forms and so forth. Then I'll stop there. That's and turn it over to Alex.
I would say my main concern is the diminishment of the Academy building, and I'm just concerned that, you know, it's this, now it's this sort of stately looming building and in its own right, and I'm just concerned that these new buildings will diminish it, you know, in part because there's less view sheds to it, but in part because the massing of those, of the new buildings is just pretty big comparatively. And I know that there's, you know, I mean, economics come into it and a lot of other factors, but, you know, and there's always that struggle between compatibility and differentiation and how do you achieve that balance. But I do feel like the massing is an important aspect, just in terms of trying to get the scale. And I don't know whether it's, you know, issue of height, because it does extend above the peak, right? But it's not about, necessarily above the cupola.
It's about 8 feet above the peak. So the top of the parapet's about 8 feet above the peak of the roofs.
Okay.
So, you know, that was obviously taken into account, and economics is a big part of that. Mm-hmm. But also how that, you know, again, how it'll feel from the pedestrian perspective, and will you notice the difference in those 8 feet? Pitch roof versus flat roof, I think, is a big part of that.
Yeah.
So are you right up at your 75-foot height limit?
No.
That's 72 feet?
I think it's 69 feet. Mm-hmm. I think it depends where you are on the site, because it slopes up significantly. So the southern building is technically taller from the grade to the top.
And then I guess I also have concerns about the, you know, the view from C Street, and that it, you know, the alignment of the buildings and their orientation seems a bit of a barrier. I mean, you know, in the ideal world, I'd love to see this revert to a campus, a really open campus feel to it. But, you know, with a building, that's impossible. But those are sort of my general concerns. I think the main thing is these buildings overshadowing the Academy building, you know, and I know that's not very specific, but that's, you know, whatever tricks you guys have to sort of bring the Academy and keep its stately presence there as much as possible, I think would be appreciated.
Thanks, Alex. Yeah, could you go to slide 35, please?
Here, I got you.
I think I can get us there.
Dueling.
Cross purposes.
This one?
Yeah. So I think we're all kind of zeroing in on this, and this is one of my concerns too. I mean, you get a sense of the overwhelming scale here and how, you know, the Academy just becomes almost shrouded from that viewpoint. And I think just the narrowness of the walkway, I'm sure the square footage and the economics and the payback on the project are all very closely aligned, but if there's any room to kind of create more space there, I think that would really help, because I do feel, as Sean and Rock had pointed out, that does kind of crowd that view. The streetlights, I think, are a nice touch. So I think you're going down the right path there. I want to thank you for sort of explaining the thought process that you've had and the debate, you know, back and forth between the cream and the brick, because, you know, I could debate this back and forth and I'd probably change my mind, you know, a dozen times in the process as well. So I understand it's not an easy thing to do. I also understand the economics of it. I do have one question, and that's on the parking. So there were some pictures from the rear view that almost look like garage doors. Is there underground parking or?
No.
Okay.
So there's probably one roll-up door in each building, which would be for trash.
Okay. And then the parking will be the back parking lot?
Yeah. Well, there's a row of parking coming off of Evergreen. Let's see if I can. There's, yeah. So you can see here rows of parking there, but the majority of the parking is surface parking on the back side of the site.
Mm-hmm.
And are you double counting where commercial, residential as shared spaces, or are they
spaces? Some of that we will do just to maximize parking. Right now we have a little bit over a 1-to-1 ratio of the requirement, so which exceeds what you would require. But yeah, we're going to try and share parking as much as possible between commercial uses, residential uses, and the academy to the extent necessary. That's easier said than done, but we have done it in the past where residential tenants are only there in the evening, so...
except for you put housing in this part of town, they're gonna, a lot of them are going to leave their cars there all day.
Yes, that's very possible. And these days, too, we actually have tenants, so a lot of tenants that work from home. Mm-hmm. But I would say that probably 20% of the parking could realistically have double use. But it presents a challenge.
Are
you done?
Okay. So I know everyone's focusing on that, I guess, what was your slide? C Street.
35.
So when I looked at it, I thought, well, Building A does, there's a few, to me it's not both buildings that would be, you know, an issue for design on the site. I think it is more of the Building A. And some thoughts on that is, looking at the height allowance of being, you know, up to 200 feet. And if you walk around the site and you look at the site from the north end, and you're on the street, there's a row of mature trees, and you don't see the academy building. And so my question back to you would be, why isn't a 200-foot building on the north end of the site nowhere? Because I would focus this, like a lower, even a lower building as a Building A, and put the height and the density towards the back of the site, there's already not, where you have more allowances for height. Well, you have allowances for height here as well, as you are aware.
So I don't think they do. The general part of this town has 200, but I'm pretty sure this...
No, it's 75 to
it's 75
feet.
At the site.
That's
no,
what I just said.
200 feet.
But
that's what I said, yeah.
But
which is amazing.
No, I mean the entire district, I'm pretty sure, is limited to 75.
No, it's up to 200
feet. No, it's up to 200 feet.
A lot of the buildings are limited by the FAA downtown. That's really the main...
The FAA is a different issue.
Yeah, well, the FAA is going to limit this to 75 feet, but the zoning height could go to 200.
So where I'm going with this...
Yeah, so the short answer to that is economics, is building 5-story wood frame or 4-story over one concrete podium.
Right, you have to go to
is economically practical. Once you go above that, you're talking about steel or concrete buildings, which in this market, other than the waterfront, which I even there question whether they're going to work, it's just economically not viable to do it.
So that's so part of it is that idea of perhaps some of the obstacles or the where you're hearing folks, you know, feel alarmed is that you do have these basically two identical buildings. They do feel like they are blocking as a wall-ish. And if you stepped up, you could step up the height of one of the buildings, lower the other one. That might help feel less like a wall. Also, thinking in terms of the library, that corridor right there is a huge community corridor to Fort Vancouver activities. It's packed full of people. When we have other events downtown, it's packed. So even having a rooftop that's lower, some of these rooftops, you know, up at the fifth level, they're not engaging. I can imagine if you lived in this building and you're more at maybe a second or third story rooftop. Now you're actually kind of engaging more with what's happening on the street when all of these festivities are happening. Those are some of my thoughts. So maybe that building would step up. There's also opportunities in some cities where they've actually connected the buildings higher up. So you've created, and this one is beyond, I don't work for the city of Vancouver, so I don't know if you're allowed to do some sort of a bridge up top and actually make better use of connecting the buildings, but allowing that view corridor to happen. Like I said, just, yeah, Building A, I think, could be configured a little differently, maybe even into two buildings, so you have more of a, and the other building may get larger. So just some thoughts on breaking up that wall of Building A, because that's really what's blocking the site more than Building B. Mm-hmm. And then I think I already mentioned about the the landscaping and just having a sense of going, having larger landscaping areas for the potential to have larger trees someday. Mm-hmm. And that idea of, I don't see it, so I know these are your initial plans, but I don't see that, how it could be continuous with that road coming in. It just seems like a huge, the way that's placed. Yeah, it seems like it would always be a barrier unless you somehow maybe had arches over that road or something. Mm-hmm. Bring, you know, vines.
Are you talking about off of the evergreen or off?
Off of the evergreen. Okay. Just connecting landscaping a little bit more. And also, when you asked about balconies, I'm not an architect, and but there's more wood, you know, that you see in the balconies on the other buildings. So just bringing maybe at some level that you have more of those, the wood pilasters or wood, somehow some of those more distinctive architectural wood features in this building might be something, or mimic it more with metal. I come from a family that does wrought iron and metalwork, and you can bring in more of those historical metal elements too, maybe to the balconies rather than have everything so square.
That's been a suggestion. There's mm-hmm. wrought iron on the front steps. It's not original. It was all wood railings.
Right.
There, but there's mm-hmm. wrought iron on the front steps of the academy that we've been discussing.
So those were the things that I
wood's challenging noticed. To make work mm-hmm. On buildings like this, but wrought iron is feasible. So, well, Mike, do we? So in I just want to emphasize that all of these things, not all of them, some of the suggestions are not on the list and things that we will consider. But you know, don't think we don't realize and have thought about quite a bit, pretty much all of the comments that you've made. And I know this isn't always the answer people want to hear, but the reality is economics drives a lot of this, especially when it comes to a density issue. And that's really where you end up with massing is it's a density issue. So, and Mike, it's probably take 1 minute to speak to this a little more, but, you know, this, the intent of this really is to create economics to preserve the academy. So you might lose a little bit in that effort, but it might be the only way to actually preserve the academy long term. So that's really where the density comes from. You know, if we had a choice, would we make these two-story buildings? Maybe. But it's just unrealistic to produce enough economics to preserve the academy with that kind of density. And it's the reality.
I think you said it well, and I think this is very important for us to get your feedback. The advisory team will be meeting and reviewing all the feedback that we've received online, public comments, open house, obviously from the commission, and frankly making a recommendation on here's what's feasible going forward. And I mean, to your point, there's a lot of economics to play in the academy today relative, and it's not just the building. It's every time it rains, the basement floods in the academy because there's no stormwater drainage on that site. It's all those different pieces that we're not just talking about money. We're talking about the improvements of this site in the way that enables the preservation of the academy building. And so your feedback's very important, very well taken, and as well as feedback from the public.
Thank you for bringing it forward to us.
Thank you.
On the economics, have you guys included Don Rickma's work on preservation economics in your planning?
We've done a lot of research on all of that in our planning.
Because developments like this don't always have such a great history on the economics standpoint. The mixture of the new and the old, he's got some very good work on how to make the two of them work together because of the historic failures, so you should definitely take a very close look at his work.
And the head of the National Trust for Historic Preservation has done some great work in writings, too, with regards to the stimulation of these types of projects in downtown, too. So, yeah.
Also, I just have one question. You know, as we discuss the west side of the property, what are the plans, you know, we want to think, you know, be thinking about these in reference to what's going to be happening to the north and east and everything? And
I mean, I would just say that, you know, the whole goal here is to create a unified campus where there's not appearance of a division of property owners, but there's consistency throughout this campus. Frankly, we're really working on what can be an appropriate strategy implemented to save that smokestack on the northeastern part of the site. I mean, that is a huge barrier and challenge relative to the development on the northeastern side of this capping system. So I think once we can deal with some of the economics of that piece, and frankly deal with some of the immediate needs of the campus of the academy building, I think that enables some more of that master planning to take place in the northern side of the campus and the eastern side of the campus.
Yeah, thank you for working on that too, Mike, because I know we gave you a hard time about that smoke stuff.
I was there
but
as well.
It is it is an iconic feature and
I love the smokestack.
Yeah.
The smokestack's great. It's a complicated structural piece of the site.
Understood.
It's just the reality.
This site plays an important role for off-site parking users too, and so I think we're trying to be sensitive to the downtown community and parking needs downtown, in that there's not just 4 acres that is taken off the line from downtown parking and has another economic impact in the community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'll just wrap this up by saying that Alex and I were up in Port Townsend at the Revitalized Washington conference last week, and we went out and we visited Fort Worden separately, and you know that's a property that was about $78 million in the hole in terms of deferred maintenance. And literally many of those properties were on the verge of demolition, right? And so finding these types of solutions and paths forward so that we can preserve these historic assets, even if it's not perfect and ideal all the time, is an important part of the process. So we look forward to working with you as we go forward from here.
Well, we look forward to engaging you on all the other educational programs that are taking place inside the Academy with the augmented reality app and other features so that the Academy really becomes an experiential destination for people in our community too. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Maybe we'll take a short break. So if anybody is not interested in Fort Lewis or the minutes of our last two meetings or anything like that, you're welcome to leave. And thank you all for coming.
You mean Lewisville Park? I was like, Fort Lewis.
Oh, I'm sorry. Lewisville Park.
Army girl here. I was like, what?
What?
I mean, the interesting thing about the board is
I conferred with some of my reservation colleagues, and I encountered basic
I've never seen the movie. Like I haven't seen the movie, but it was made very clear. Like, haven't seen the movie.
Well, you got to see it.
The tour.
I wish Rob would have another architect on opinions. That's going to be the hardest thing for them.
I'm just thinking, you've got the Academy, you know, back here, you know, this thing, and I just don't understand. I could just see, you know, a building kind of, you know, rising up from here, maybe, you could even do, you know, but you would, like you said, you could still have a building here if you wanted, but
That's a much wider looking rendering than the one, than another one that they had.
You know, you could cut this building over a little more and step it up. clubs. You know, yeah. there's ways.
Yeah.
Give it a little more space.
This line right
that's
here.
That's what I'm trying to say.
I think like cutting it there or having that be the two-story portion. Or
yeah.
I know it seems funny that to not have this whole facade be this movie. I know that 11th Street Riot is a dedicated right of way. You can't do much about that. But
or, you know,
nice.
Like I suggested, you could have, you could step this back a little bit more maybe, but you could have this up here and you could bridge Chicago Street.
I thought about that.
And then you have more open. And it would stretch it better. I've seen other cities do that sort of thing of, you know, openings to different, you know,
story.
Yeah. But I don't have like architectural advice and comments.
No, I hope I did try to without scaring people in the crowd. Let's start from the beginning. How about that?
That's the beginning.
So,
Louisville SART, do they want to actually table it? Dan, who's our facilities guy, who knows everything, is sick today.
Oh.
So, I'll take any feedback you might have tonight, but he says that, or they said they'll come back.
Let's just come back.
Okay.
All right. Rather, it's already in.
So, did you hear that, Rob?
No.
I suggest.
Louisville Park, the Dan, who's kind of the guy that knows it all, he's sick today, so they've asked him if they could come in June.
Oh, okay, so you just postponed that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So I announced that.
So what is like, you can work on trade-offs, and then you can find a trade-off.
You want to do St. James next? You don't want to just start from the beginning? Except those two that are St. James here.
Since we're already on the staff,
there's a limitation
on the play there. But you're never going to get around
that. Because the code update.
Okay, are we ready?
I'm gonna,
yep.
Yeah, three stories.
All right. So, Jackie, yeah.
Gamble.
Back to it.
Yeah. So, I've just received word that Mr. Spencer is not able to attend tonight. So, Louisville Park, which I accidentally said Fort Lewis is not on the agenda tonight. Louisville Park is going to be postponed until our June meeting. So, if you're interested in our discussion on Louisville Park, you're welcome to come back in June and we'll give it our full attention. Right now, I think we're going to move on to St. James Catholic Church. We have an informational update on a new chapel, a small chapel that's being built on the grounds. So,
commissioners, I'm not Keith Jones. I'm Mark Person. I'm a new senior planner at the City of Vancouver, and I'll be one of your main points of contact for projects. In the city of Vancouver moving forward.
All right.
Taking some of John Wagner's caseload as he retired here about 6 weeks ago. So we have this, and I'm playing Greg Turner, our land use manager tonight. He's actually reviewing this case file.
All right, take it away, Mark.
But this came to us, a new 310 square foot freestanding chapel located at the northeast corner of the St. James property at 218 West 12th Street. The building is about 18 by 18. Thank you for putting that on the screen there, Jackie. It will be approximately 31 feet in height. The existing cathedral was built in, we believe, 1884 to 1885. The cathedral building was placed on the Washington State Historic Register in 1974, but it is not on the local or national register. So the city, the commission does not need to review the submittals. This is not on the local register. We're just passing this along to staff for informational purposes only. And, you know, feel free to contact Greg Turner, and I'll leave my information here as well if you have any comments. And I'm happy to take any thoughts you have tonight as well. But there's a rendering on the screen there, and I think as part of your packets, that shows what this might look like if it moves forward.
I know I'm often one to harp on false historicity, but buildings like this kind of shift that a little bit when you're talking about the original owner, you know, as far as extending you know, almost like the original development. I think the one piece of feedback that I would have is some sort of differentiation in the design so that it's clearly from another era. Now, even if it's as simple as a date stone, but you know, I think something that makes that clear in the architecture, you know, a detail in the architecture that is very different, because I mean everything in this chapel is pulled from somewhere on the church. Now, everything is reminiscent of somewhere else on the church. So there isn't any differentiation at all. And I don't think there needs to be a lot of differentiation, but at least something.
See, people aware that it's not original.
So I had the same concern, obviously, because those are the standards. But I think it is sufficiently differentiated. I mean, it's very similar, but it's a very small building, right? It's offset from the rest. But if you actually look at the arches or the white stone over it, it's not as ornate as it is on the cathedral itself. The windows are simplified. It's slightly more modern. The roof pitch is different. So I understand your concern, but personally, I'm comfortable with it.
Oh, I don't know. With it. They put a date stone on it. I'd be comfortable with it.
Rock, what are your thoughts?
Well, echoing much of what I've heard, but I saw it, and I got to say, the first thing that came to my mind was, why? You know, what's the function of the building, and what's it for?
It's got a name. I think the function is.
I can't say that I know that.
It's like a little dome.
It's the adoration chapel.
You know,
adoration chapel.
Adoration. So is it like, were you? Is there a?
There's a tabernacle in there. There's worship. Kneelers. It's a prayer chapel. Places where you go. There's if you're Catholic. It's a tabernacle in there. It's got a sacrament in there. There were kneelers, a handicapped spot for prayer. It's got a key, private key entry. People sign in to go in, and it's a private place for prayer.
Okay. I am Catholic, by the way. I just have never seen anything quite like this.
And it will have the original tabernacle that was in the church when Mother Joseph, when the church was built during Mother Joseph's time. So that original tabernacle will be in that chapel.
Okay.
It's kind of like St. Anne's Chapel if you go to the grotto.
It's
very tiny.
I think actually the biggest concern that I would bring is more from a long-term preservation standpoint. So I used to work for Partners for Sacred Places that worked to, you know, maintain historic houses. And the directionality of the door faced away from the church. I understand why it's faced that way, because it makes it easy to enter. But we saw so many churches with unused outbuildings. I think creating a stronger connection between entrance and the church, I think, is something, you know, I don't know if it's
not possible.
Not possible, because I didn't know what the limitations were for locating that chapel.
There's a lot of stuff underground out there. And even some of what we've got now based on contractor bids will change slightly.
So I think even just the direction of it, not even changing where it's located, but even just the direction that it's facing, you know, if it can face toward the parish hall, it's something to consider to make sure that space stays as optimally usable as possible, so that in the future someone doesn't say, this is a somewhat awkward space. I'm going to put chairs in here.
Storage.
Yeah.
I like it. I think it's cute.
Well, I like it quite a bit, and I like the idea. You know, it's an issue in our urban fabric where it's difficult to keep churches open all the time. So the fact that it gives a space for Catholics in downtown so that they can go somewhere, you know, I think that that's a great thing for the urban fabric. So I don't want you to think that I don't like it. I'm just... Those are things to consider that might make it even better.
And I like it. I think Robert said it's kind of cute. And it is. It is kind of cute. And I like the location on the site for the symmetry with the main building, and, you know, aligning on the axis of the main building, and that has a feel good for me. I like that there's a lot packed onto this site in, you know, variety and texture and spaces and outdoor rooms and things, and I think this could really add to that. So I think it's kind of cool.
I have no issues.
I also have no issues. I think it looks good.
Great. Well, thanks for the update.
Thanks so much. Thank you. I look forward to working with you more in the future. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
All right, so Lewisville Park's postponed till next month, and we've got this mystery item on the agenda here about mid-century modern architecture lecture proposal.
Yes. And it's got
your name on it.
Yes, I'll be very brief. There's the JCPenney building in downtown Vancouver. Mm-hmm. Teresa Brum from the city has been talking to them about the incentives that come along with listing on the national or the local register, the special valuation, and they were interested in that. Mm-hmm. And we were wondering, she was going to have to see if Michael Hauser or the crew from DAP could come down and maybe talk to the property owners about the incentives and what types of programs, with the federal tax credits and other ways that you could renovate the property and save some money and do it financially feasibly. And we were kind of talking about, well, you know, we have lots of property owners that might benefit from that information. Mm-hmm. So we were thinking, and mid-century, that kind of time frame is now coming upon us. We probably have some property owners that may have no idea that their building may be eligible for a national register. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the thought, was getting them, they came down here many years ago, just talked overall about how to list your property and the different architectural styles that Vancouver and Clark County have. So it'd be kind of similar to that. They would have, we'd invite them down, set up a lecture kind of format, invite property owners, spread the word. They could focus on mid-century, or we could do a more broader sense, but it's just a way to kind of encourage the property owners to consider listing.
I think actually you should go further than making it a lecture. Actually invite the property owners, you know, send out, actual event just for them because then it's not just that, well, maybe I'll stop by. We're actually doing it because you are an owner of that building style.
Yeah, we can do it that way.
I think it's a good bit of proactive preservation because across the country, mid-century modern has been a real challenge for preservation because while architects love it, most of the public doesn't.
Yeah.
And so we're losing them rapidly.
Yeah.
And so I think proactively engaging the owners about preserving them, you know, as they're becoming eligible, and actually a lot of them really should already be eligible, I think is a really good idea.
Okay. All right. And I mean, you know, opening up to other cities as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So kind of figuring out where that is, who they are, is going to take some help. So think about it. And I'll look into it more and see what I can find out and what we have, like, at least inventoried or not, or on the radar. Mm-hmm. And I'll put something together and run it by you guys and try to get a date for Michael and the crew to come down and find a spot where we can do it and everything.
So one bit of news that I found out up at the Revitalized Washington is Russ Holter has left DAP.
Okay.
And is going to be moving to Clark County.
Oh.
And will be available for, I think, consulting work. So he might be a good resource to call upon if we, you know, have a need. Yeah. If we don't, can't engage DAP, but he might be a good resource considering he knows a lot of those, things.
Good
options.
Okay.
I don't know if it's completely appropriate for the talk that you're proposing, but perhaps inviting a testimonials and appearances at that meeting by
property owners
who have taken advantage of this, and the Dean Irvin comes to mind.
Yeah, and Bruno Luki.
Although I do recall him going, never again. So I don't know.
But I think after they came down and talked to him, and after that he was convinced. So if we can get some more property owners to hear that, we'll get more on the register and renovate it. Mm-hmm. That'd be good. Okay,
great.
More to come. So that's it.
All right. Well, let's just back up and let's do the minutes approval really quickly.
Okay.
Couldn't one just flip everything entirely and save it till the end?
So we've got a 2-month backlog on our minutes approval here. Let's see, minutes from the March 6th meeting. We're all present except Sarah. So I had an opportunity to review this prior to this meeting. I have no comments about this.
That's a school concert, by the way. I wasn't just skipping out. Just for the record.
Say
you're putting your kids before
I
this.
Did, just so you know.
So, Jackie, the only thing I have on that minutes are page 3 up at the top, the first paragraph. It said Haney suggested Hemwood. Is that Hemlock?
Probably.
Okay. Hemwood?
Hemwood.
Hemwood?
On the fourth line.
Sean, is that what you think it was?
Hemlock is a wood. Hemlock
is
not.
Yeah.
And then down at the bottom, it says Friedman shared that when he was on the edge, it's just Fried.
Okay, same page?
Yeah.
Okay, yes, I got it. All right.
And then Holly, do you spell your name with an E-Y?
No.
And then, so her name too is EY throughout.
Yes, okay, thank you.
I had two other names of guests, just because they happen to be friends. Caroline Mercury is C A R O L I N E.
I was wondering about that.
And Brian Hathert is Brian Halbert. H A L B E R T.
Spelling of H A?
H A L B E R T.
Albert.
Albert.
Got it.
Yeah. Albert.
Sometimes it's hard to read the.
Yeah.
But thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if there's no more comments about the minutes from the March 6th meeting, I'd be happy if someone would move to approve.
I move to approve. The second. Minutes from March 6th.
Okay, have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. March 6th is approved. Moving forward in time to April 3rd. Only 3 people showed up for this meeting, or 3 commissioners. So I was not present. I have no comments. We've got Sarah, Sean, and Rock present, so... Give me all an opportunity to look that over and then entertain a motion to approve whenever you're ready.
I reviewed the minutes. I didn't see any corrections that I thought needed to be made.
Yeah, me either.
Well, then I move to approve the minutes from April 3rd.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Minutes are approved from March and April. Okay. Back up to date. Let's guess we'll jump in on the public hearing on the Clark County Historic Preservation Code update. Okay, so we'll begin by asking the commissioners present if anybody has any conflicts of interest or ex parte contacts with respect to this public hearing. If not, we will consider the hearing opened and hear your staff report.
Hold on, 10 papers.
Yeah, it was 2 pages. Do we have it here?
Got it.
It was attached to the minutes, but I don't see it here.
Okay, I don't need it.
Okay, so
this is a hearing for review and recommendation to main processes, first to the Planning Commission. So it's for the revised code for 4250030 of the Clark County Development Code for Historic Preservation. And as you recall, throughout the last year, various cases and reviews that we went through, we noticed some things that we could clean up and make more accurate, more clarify some processes, move things around from that may have been in the rules and procedures that should have been in the code and vice versa. Making sure that we had clear appeals process and review process for our hearing processes. So those are kind of the main headers and some of the editorial things that you'll see. There's more that I'll talk to you about that legal has found. So I want to kind of go over the kind of versions that we've had. So you all have had reviews, the two work sessions technically. So we've incorporated revisions throughout those two reviews. We, after our April meeting, we took those revisions and we prepared the latest version at that point. We had a 15-day legal notice period, so we had to post the code and a staff report, which we did a couple Fridays ago. Our legal staff, Christine Cook, was out of town, so she had to review it after she got back. So when she got back, she took a look at all that we did, and then she had some comments. And that's the one that we said that was the revised version that had the yellow highlights. So you can kind of see what was different from what was the previous version. So I'll briefly go over kind of what she had found. And then we can open it up to whatever else that you have found or want to discuss or have questions about. So I want to start with definitions first, just to kind of get that piece, because some one of the definitions kind of goes out throughout the whole code and changes some stuff. We added a definition for properties or property. So our original iterations, we wanted to make sure that when we're talking about sites, structures, objects, properties, however you want to call it, that are being nominated, that we know that it encompasses all those things. And instead of having to carry on that da-da-da-da-da every time we want to talk about it, Chris's suggestion was like, why don't you just define it, and then that definition will mean for this section what you want it to say. So you'll see that change. So now properties is a defined term in this, specific to this section, referred to throughout the entire code.
Oh,
so
that's great.
That's why.
We never really had a good solution to that problem. Yeah. That's a good solution.
Jackie, I wonder if as we go through these changes, yeah, we just kind of check them off.
Yes.
So is everybody okay with that change in definition? Okay.
Okay. Forward. So let's start with the next one that was a big one that we added that she wanted to define was party of record. So we use that term a lot, especially, so that's for when there's an appeal or someone might want to appeal. So you have to be a party of record. And we say that term, but we didn't define it. So this gives it clear how you are a party of record and what that means. So that's a new definition
defined anywhere else in Clark County Code?
No.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Not the way she wanted it. Right?
Okay.
It really is. Not the way she wanted it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, is it consistent then?
Most cities define what a party of record is.
We made sure that it encompassed as many people that we would think would want to be a party of record and was clear on that. That was her main point. She wanted to make sure that everyone who wanted to have an opportunity did, and it didn't close off anybody that did participate. Mm-hmm. So that was her point of hers. So the rest of the definitions are just some cleanups.
Is everybody okay with the party of record definition?
I think that might actually slow us down if you do that every time.
Well, I don't want to kind of get lost and have to backtrack.
The definitions are important enough. So party of record is defined elsewhere in the code?
It is, but it's not as inclusive as it is here.
Yeah.
Okay. Are they conflicting at all?
No.
This one's just more encompassing?
Yeah. Cut and paste, but made more inclusive.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm fine.
Great.
The other thing that she's fixed some editorial grammar things, but a big one was the Oxford commas. So the Oxford commas are huge.
Yeah, that was one of my comments. Okay, go ahead.
They're now fixed throughout the entire code. So that's why you'll see a lot of little highlights on the commas.
Okay. All right.
So she's taking them out or put them
putting
in?
Putting them in.
Them in.
Oh, she's putting them in.
Yes.
I thought she was taking them out. I couldn't really tell. It was just a tiny little yellow squiggle mark.
Seems like everybody's gone.
Okay. If she's putting them in, I'm okay with it.
All right.
I've started to.
I'm a strong believer in the Oxford comma.
I am for codes, but not for casual writing.
So, okay, so anything else that...
The stuff we talk about in here, I mean, come on.
The other highlights in the definitions are just kind of editorial, so if you have any questions about any of that, let's hear it. Okay, so now I want to go back to page one. Section B. So applicability. And Robert sent me an email today that made me reread this again, and I needed to fix it. And with Sharon's help. So, because it was never, I wanted to be true to what we actually do review and make that clear, because there's only certain things we do with National Register properties, and there's certain things we do with the Clark County Heritage Register. So on this new sheet that I provided you, which I'm going to call the errata sheet from now on, because mm-hmm. I'll add to it if there's something more that we come up with tonight that we all want to, I want everyone to be on the same page. So we've changed it, and we made a clean version so it was easier to read on the second part. But what we did is we broke it out. So the first one has to do with the cultural resources inventory. So the applicability of this code is either you're listed on the Clark County Cultural Resource Inventory or you're applying to be. And then part number two is you're either listed on the National Register of Historic Places or Washington State Heritage Register, or DAP has requested the commission to review and provide recommendation on a nomination per section 4250.030.D4F, which is under your rules or your duties that you do that function. And then three, listed on the Clark County Heritage Register or for which a nomination application to be listed has been filed with preservation staff. So Chris, another thing for Chris was making sure that we had actors for all our actions. Mm-hmm. And so you'll see kind of some clarifications on who does what rather than the what. So what do you, I'll give you a couple seconds, but any...
Okay, so how does this tie in the eligibility piece?
So the we had the eligibility originally in the original code. I think Sean was one of the first people that we had a conversation about. There's no one that can determine eligibility before it gets to you all to review. And so at first we changed it to under consideration. Mm-hmm. And Chris, she wasn't digging that too much. So she wanted to make sure that it's you're either on it, because then you have to follow these things. Like if you're on the register, then you have to abide by these sections of code for a review, a certificate of appropriateness. Or you've applied and you have an application submitted that you all are reviewing for being listed. Mm-hmm.
But you don't apply to be on the cultural resource inventory.
You do.
Oh, you do?
There's an application, yeah. And that per section K, the last section, talks about that.
So I think the one issue with that is that, you know, one of our roles is, you know, to provide comments on applications. So if...
Or the survey, the inventory?
No, just provide comment on any application. No, I just had it. No, I lost it.
Let's see where you're going.
Provide for comment by the Commission on all applications for approvals, permits, environmental assessments, or cultural statements and other similar documents pertaining to identified historical or cultural resources or adjacent properties. So if a property has stayed off of the list and is not being under consideration, does that eliminate our ability to comment to the city about... or the county about those properties and the preservation issues that might be there, even if these aren't listed properties?
So it's not on a register.
It's not under consideration.
It's not under consideration. Yep.
But it's more than 50 years old. That's where it comes in, right?
Well, where does the properties that are within the overlay fit into this chapter?
This is county, so it's only properties outside of the city of Vancouver. Mm. So it doesn't take into the heritage.
The different
code.
Okay.
Code for that.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, our invited. Yeah, our advisory rights to, in this case, the county. On
if we had a property that wasn't on anything, mm-hmm. we just wanted some feedback.
Yeah, if they hadn't filed an application yet, or
if you wanted feedback, or if we wanted to give you feedback, because it's important.
That was the point of my email earlier today. As I was looking at this last night ahead of this meeting, I was like, okay, this really kind of depends on the property being on the cultural resource inventory. But we're not really maintaining that, right? And we have resource challenges to kind of keep that fresh. And so by taking out the eligibility term, we kind of limit ourselves in our ability to get involved.
I mean, in general, a cultural resource inventory isn't something that is initiated by the landowner.
It can be.
It can be, but I mean, I don't know. I'm confused about the whole Clark County Cultural Resource Inventory. I mean, to me, it doesn't seem like a tool that's being used. Or, I mean,
it is used for, like, if something's flat, like I can flag a permit or a property owner that may not know, and I get notified, and I can reach out to that property owner.
But how does something get put on the Clark County inventory? I mean, you know, we've had some inventories through, I mean, there was a big one in the 70s where, you know, that was done. But, you know, Holly, you've done some around town, you know, in the city of Vancouver. But, I mean, those property owners didn't specifically request or, you know, I mean, we're doing, like, as a consultant, I'm doing surveys, you know, in downtown Longview, for instance. I know not Clark County, but, you know, I mean, those building owners have no idea that I'm putting their buildings on the historic property inventory.
Right.
So as an analogy for the Clark County inventory, is that a similar...
If it's... So the ones that you do that are put on the inventory, does that mean they're eligible or potentially eligible?
No.
So these are... So
eligible.
So they're at least 50 years old, and they've had a little bit of research done on the...
Oh, well, but eligible for what?
For the local register. So specific
for any
Clark
register
County.
For
Am
that.
Am I saying
matter.
That right?
But a register and an inventory are different.
Right, right.
I mean, inventory is, I mean, as the name says, it's just a list. It doesn't...
There's no teeth.
Yeah, it doesn't carry with it.
Well, it's a list with some accompanying documentation.
In this?
Not necessarily.
It's usually, yeah, they do.
They do?
Yeah.
I wasn't sure that
I mean,
it
can be minimal,
I think
though.
It's so, you've got, like, the
it's the windshield
inventory
survey.
That, like, DAFS keeps, right? And then I think Clark County, when we did a larger one, and Holly stepped in because this was your project, but in 99, it was specific to see what properties were eligible for the Clark County Heritage Register.
Within limitations, okay. Yes, because not the whole county wasn't surveyed.
Right.
But this ties into the issue that I brought up at the last meeting, which is there are the properties that are more or less officially on the Clark County inventory, but there's hundreds of other inventory forms that have been filled out that may or may not be
right.
part of the Clark County inventory.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true throughout the state, partly because definitions of inventory have changed over time. But you do have properties where they were documented at the time when the philosophy was you do an inventory for a form for every building on this block through your inventory, whether it was built 100 years ago or yesterday. And so you have things of varying ages, things that have no way of being eligible, things that are too recent, too deteriorated, whatever. So you get quite a mixed bag of what's on the inventory. So then comes up there were a whole bunch of inventory forms filled out for Columbia River Crossing when they were doing the environmental impact studies. There are inventory forms that are filled out for all kinds of different undertakings. So are those, because they're in Clark County, part of the Clark County inventory, even if the commission has never made any kind of formal statement saying that they are?
And when you're saying, like, for instance, the Columbia River Crossing, those inventories, are you saying those were put on the state inventory or the Clark County Cultural Resource
inventory? Well, it's the state form.
Yeah.
Which Clark County also uses.
But it's on file at...
It's on file through Wizard. I mean, it's on file at
the state.
But it may or may, depending on how you define the Clark County inventory, those properties may or may not be on it.
Yeah.
And we had, there's a scoring matrix, right, that was...
From 2000,
So, I mean, so there was a different, I guess, methodology.
That was a methodology that was typical at the time. There are different things that are...
Is there a place to access the Clark County Cultural Resource Inventory?
In our office?
It remains a mystery to me.
Yeah. And I think, to be honest, it does to me too, and why how it's been codified right here is kind of bizarre, but that's how it was originated. And I don't think it harms anything with what you do. I think it maybe this is that part of it is something that we look into.
I mean, it almost seems either obsolete or redundant or... if it's not being used and no one can access it, then what's the point?
Well, you can access it through also Wizard. I don't think.
But if, as you say,
Wizard, you would know whether something was on the inventory or simply was in Clark County and had a form filled out.
Yeah.
But part of the idea is it's a planning tool.
Yeah.
If you have 10 identical bridges in the county and 4 of them are threatened, do you say, well, maybe it's okay if we let those 4 go because we still have 6 left. If you get down to 1 of those bridges, that's a different issue. But it's part of it's meant to be a planning tool.
And it is being used, right? Because it does flag certain properties if they're on there, and it shows up in Wizard if you go there, right? But the point is, it's being used in some capacity.
We have it incorporated into our permit system so that it is flagged if a property owner comes in, that I can at least reach out to them and be like, do you know that you might have your building might be historically significant. Here are some information about the registers, and this is what you would need to do, and this is the incentive. So that's how I've been using it.
So my thoughts are, because I think this is kind of a complex issue, right, and we could debate it for a while, we just revert back to keeping the language about eligible to be listed in
especially
in
since
the
that's
code.
That's a term of art in preservation.
Okay.
And then that way we don't do anything to restrict ourselves here in the interest of time. I don't think there's any problems that are occurring because we have that language in there. Are there?
That was something that came up here. So
I know. I think we might have talked ourselves in a circle here.
All right. That's fine.
Maybe it's just better to leave it in.
Okay. So
give us a little more latitude.
Listed or listed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And are you good with kind of having those 3?
I think that is.
And how we...
I think it does.
Talk about the national and the Washington versus the Clark County...
I think it helps.
That's an
improvement. Okay, moving on to, let's see, the next major piece would be page 8, and that was just editorial. Chris made those changes, just at the start of the sentences. It is instead of is.
I'm sorry, what page?
8.
8.
All the criteria, the extra criteria that for categories.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So we're going to get rid of the Oxford is.
All the Oxfords.
I'm sorry. It's late.
Okay, so the next, and I'm not going to go over everything a little. Word change or phrase. If you had something that came up with you, you let me know. I'm going to do the big things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so page 9. This is the process for... So this is under the process for nominating, designating, or listing properties to the local register. We used to...
point to another section of the county's code that was for development reviews, and it was a lot longer and all the things that the county has to do to for a type 3 review process, whereas we were pointing to one specific section of bits and pieces of it, and it always got complicated and confusing, especially when I'm training someone new. You know, I wanted it to fix this, to have whatever it is that our distribution, our processes, is in our code. So that's what this is about. So what we added, and we were very specific about how we notice the hearing for a nomination, how many days prior to the hearing, which is our typical process for noticing any hearings in the county, who we distribute it to in this instance. So specifying that we send it to the applicant and the applicant's representative, the neighborhood association, property owners in the radius of either 300 or 500 feet, boundaries of the property in question, agencies with jurisdiction. So if it was a property in Camas, we would make sure we let the city of Camas know that you're hearing this. Any other known interest groups that we may have known about. So really making that clear. So that was added. And then being very clear on your process at the hearing, that you're going to hear, deliberate, and make a decision on the nomination at a public hearing. And then we wanted to know from Chris, because we have in different bits and pieces, I think it was in the rules and procedures, about what happens after you make your decision and the findings are developed and the close of the record. And when is the close of the record? Is it when you close the hearing, or is it when you list the findings? And if we do that, then, you know, you're taking another month, and sometimes people's projects want to go a little bit quicker than that. So she said that we just have to make sure that we say when the record closes. So if the hearing was finished and you weren't going to forward it or table it to another meeting, Robert or whoever was chair would say, okay, we're closing the public record after you made, you know, your deliberation. And then that means that no other further information can be submitted to the record. It's closed. So that's where that language comes in there.
So now it's codified that we have to say that.
Yes.
Or the record's still.
Yes. Yeah.
So this is
so it's something we could add to our sheet that gives us our process, so that it's always made.
Good.
Any questions?
Another
on
reason
that?
For a gavel.
Yeah. What if Robert gets mad with power and just cuts things off?
I'll try that sometime.
Probably be with me.
Yeah. Keep those comments shorter, Sean. Okay.
Okay.
So just a little nitpick. If I look at H, the commission shall hear, deliberate, and make a decision on the nomination at a public hearing, period. Oh, okay. There's a period at the end of the strikeout. Okay. Yeah. It's fine with me.
Okay. So then little one under I, I think was part of the original section. We just kind of made it a little bit more clear, moved it down, so that once you find that it's eligible, then we list it with the owner's consent. After the hearing, staff, so the actor, right, staff shall prepare the commission's decision in writing, which shall state the findings of fact and reasons relied upon in reaching its decision within 14 days of the close of the case record. So if that works for you and whoever's chair, that means that staff would develop that document that, you know, pretty much says, you know, this is why you decided this, right? You have the chair or vice chair, whoever, review it and sign off on the nomination so that we can get it to the applicant within that 14 days versus waiting for another month for you all to review it at another meeting.
I think probably what's important about that is that, and maybe that's not said here either, is that your staff reports include findings,
yes,
of fact, and reasons. And so if as we're deliberating on a decision, we should be very clear if we want changes to those findings, so that there isn't a delay, right? So,
And then if we did have any corrections to make, it would be need to be done offline during that 14-day period.
Yeah, like if we put something together that Robert was like, we didn't say that, you know, we would work with the chair. And if he, for some reason, didn't feel comfortable, then we could, of course, bring it back to the entire commission, but it would have to be at a regular public meeting.
I think it all makes sense, but I just wonder if that 14-day window is a little bit small, or maybe, you know, it can be the chair or the vice chair or something like that if one's not available.
Well, I guess with that 14 days, it makes me wonder, because we did have concerns with the findings of one of our hearings, and we weren't comfortable with it, and we brought it back. And so even though technically the hearing was closed, we were still working on the findings. It might not need to be explained here. Maybe it's more of something that goes into our handbook, but mm-hmm. don't.
The rules and procedures.
But maybe we close. So in our city, the procedures, we can close the public hearing portion of public testimony portion of the hearing, but not close the hearing. We can leave the hearing open for submittal of, you know, further written testimony or deliberations and that sort of thing. So there's a process that I think Jackie and I have had this discussion before that isn't similar here, but that's where I would see we could fit that in if we wanted to continue a hearing and not close it.
I think all that makes sense, but what's the impact to the property owner or the other constituents?
And maybe, like Sarah said, it's like if it's a kind of really straightforward nomination and the staff report covers everything and there's no
problem.
Nothing that was different in your deliberation. Mm-hmm. So it might be like that like a case by case where we're like, let's maybe you need to continue it to the next meeting.
And when you continue it, you state why you're doing it. You're clear. You know, like we are working on this issue and then if someone is concerned why you're holding it over, they could then submit comments.
So if that's the case, though, does that need to be written in here?
I don't think so.
Discretion?
No, I think you just wouldn't close the record, right?
Right.
And then in our rules and procedures, we can give some details as to how that would work.
Okay. Well, I'll defer to you, too, because you're the experts.
Well, that's why I was talking this out to say, just so that maybe that there's agreement that that would be a procedure that we would follow if we have another one of those rare situations where we're not comfortable quite with how the findings, you know, or the conditions.
I was just thinking of, for example, Dean Irvin came to mm-hmm. us and he was trying to get a property in by the end of the year, right? And mm-hmm. so in that type of, we wouldn't want to impact the property owner, right? We would want to be expedient in the process. That's all I was thinking.
You know, I think the biggest issue is just that when we make any decision, I think we need to be explicit at the end, you know, what the findings are to be recorded in the findings. Mm-hmm. You know, that these are the 3 findings, the 4 findings, the 5 findings, here's the decision. And we just need to make that explicit as we close, you know, we close the record, say, you know, enumerate our findings, agree that those are the findings, and I think that handles a lot of the time issue.
Yeah. Whatever Sarah thinks.
Okay. Oh my goodness.
The next one is just adding the actor to the commission staff shall ensure that the following actions are taken with regard to each property, which is listed. So there's steps that we take to record the certificate. We note it in the permit and on the maps online, our county maps. So that was just giving that who's doing what piece. Everyone okay with that? Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. Page 13 is the next bigger highlighted area, and this was regarding what happens if there's some kind of an emergency demolition or alteration that needs to happen per the building official. So this is some text that Sharon helped put together and worked with Jim Muir, our county building official, on. So he's good with it. Chris Cook is good with it. Seems to
Sean have given lots of input on this too.
Yep.
Okay. Sounds thoroughly better to me.
Yes.
Page 14 on D, we just added kind of header there so you knew appeals of staff decision.
Easy to find.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Easy to find. We changed from, what was it? Appellant before? Petitioner.
Petitioner, yeah.
We changed from petitioner to appellant. And then under, on page 15, little 3A, clarifying that process. Historic Preservation Commission shall hear appeals in a public hearing. Staff shall provide notice of an appeals hearing by mailing notification to the parties of record and publishing notice in the newspaper of general circulation and
so
by
weird.
Posting the notice on the property. So almost the same kind of process we do for the hearing. Chris wanted to make sure that we were as transparent and provided enough opportunity for whoever was interested to kind of participate.
It is strange the way she needs to have that little A after that when it's just, you know, what makes it any different than little D on the previous page? Do you know what I'm saying? You have appeals of staff decision, period, and then you have an ex, you know, you have text, and then
right.
Appeal decision, you have a little A, and no B, C, D.
Well, that's just the process.
I'm just talking about, like, why would you have a sub-letter if there's no other sub-letters?
Oh, true.
Give it an A.
That would be my preference.
Yeah.
It looks silly with just a little A there. But I thought that you said that she likes the little...
No, we missed it.
Oh, okay. Then never mind.
Yeah.
We'll figure
it out. We'll double check that with
her. I mean, yeah, there's a reason for it in terms of a legalese.
Well, little D just says appeals of staff decision, and it gives explanation. And then, so, okay. It's nothing substantive, so just...
Usability.
Yes.
Code usability.
Just a little strange thinking.
Page 16. Every time you look at this, something
will jump at
up.
You. Yeah.
Page 16. I don't know why that's green. I think that was a carryover from our work. So this is, again, doing the same thing as we had talked about under the nominations, but under the certificate of appropriateness process.
Mm-hmm.
So Matt, doing the same thing. So
mm-hmm.
how we notice a hearing. We post it in the paper, we post the property, and this is who we send it to. So it just matches that previous section. And the same kind of process for deliberation and close the record and findings.
Okay.
Okay. 17, big G, just adding appeals of the Historic Preservation Commission's decision versus appeals of staff decision.
Oh, okay.
So nothing changed anywhere there. That's from Chris.
Yes. On B.
Yeah. B.
17. The commas there.
Page 17 B.
Because the comma that she has added changes the meaning.
Which one?
So offers to lease, sell. Or dedicate, does it? Wait, let me reread. I'm making sure I'm not.
How does this change it?
I think it's good.
Nope, never mind.
It's okay.
To be.
Had a brain stumble.
Mm-hmm.
I've had many, but this could. Page 18 is good. Page 19, pretty, you know, editorial stuff for actors, making sure we're clear on who's doing what.
Okay.
Nothing on 20, but those kind of changed the properties. Same as 21. J, interlocal agreements, just kind of clarifying some language on the commission may act on behalf of an incorporated city within Clark County if an interlocal agreement for that purpose is in effect between the city and Clark County. Just kind of clarifying some language that she was more comfortable with.
So I have a quick question. In the Clark County Code, defined terms are capitalized,
yes,
not italicized?
Right.
Oh. Are defined terms supposed to be capitalized all the time? Because
no.
I saw party of record.
No, I think we did properties, right, because it had that encompassing many...
And it has a different meaning in other sections of the code.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay. I gotta go back to section D for a second. second.
Okay. Which one?
Section E. Yeah, section E, number 8. The part about the National Register, where is it?
That's under...
Is it gone now?
No, it's under... Powers and duties, so, and that is exactly on page 6. Top of the page. Is that what you were talking about?
Oh.
Yeah.
Or are you talking about the cross?
It's also on E. We cross it off on E because we put it in the powers and duties.
So we used to have a section E, National Register.
Yeah. So, go back and look at the old one. I'm getting lost. Yeah, there was a section E, National Register of Historic Places. Where is that being addressed here?
On F.
Top of the page.
Top of the page.
6.
Yeah, missed the page. Oh, whoops, no. This one right here.
Next page six.
Mm-hmm.
Bear with me. Okay. Review nominations to the National Register of Historic Places. According to, okay, so you put that back in then.
Well, it was always there.
It was always there. Mm-hmm. It just looked like it was gone because section.
We had a whole separate section for it, which required a hearing that we
right.
that we don't do.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. My only concern was making sure that we still review nominations and provide some type of feedback. So that's still there. I was under the impression that it had been removed completely. And the reason for that comment was I've had conversations with DAP in the past where they've told me that they really rely on the local HPC's input, right? So if we were to remove ourselves from that process, then you have some people who don't have the local expertise weighing in on it. So they should be at least be, you know, looking at whatever letter of recommendation or whatever it is that we provide. Which I, even though this is rather sparse, I suppose it still covers that and it still keeps our role in place there. So,
do we want to include the part of, because there's review nominations in the National Register, do we want to include and make recommendation to DAP as a duty on this, according to our rules and procedures, or is that implied enough in the review?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I don't see a harm in that, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, this, you know, nominations can sometimes get contentious, and so what the commission might do or not do, mm-hmm. I think we don't want to leave that up to anything but what the ordinance tells us to do.
Right.
So do you
want
to add review nominations and provide recommendations to the National Register of Historic Places?
Provide to DAP.
So nominations.
Because DAP is our ship.
Right.
Review DAP. Nominations to the National Register of Historic Places and provide DAP, provide recommendations to DAP according to criteria, mm-hmm. and rules and procedures, and
yeah.
we can
yeah.
add a little bit more.
Yeah, you know, that sounds good.
Because what happens currently, mm-hmm. staff just tells DAP, oh yeah.
No, we bring it forward before you.
Yeah, they have.
The issue I've had with DAP's schedule and our schedule, so right now we had this hearing code, right? And they may call and be like, 3 weeks out.
Right.
And
yeah.
I'd have to be like, well, I can't get it on the hearing, and then it would miss their quarterly meeting. So it was given, I put in a constraint on their schedule, whereas I don't think it's necessary for us to have a public hearing, just recommendations. I think if we could do it in a public meeting, mm-hmm. that's
okay.
plenty.
Do we also want to mention in that the keeper of the Register of Historic Places, because that's the other way that buildings are placed on the National Register, is either through the SHPO or through the keeper.
Well, I think how, so
This recommendation goes to the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, right? So that's the committee up in Olympia. And then they incorporate, they take your recommendation, and Holly can jump in because I'm sure she's more familiar, and then they provide a recommendation to the federal government on whether it should be listed.
Yeah, we go through them.
Right, but the federal legislation allows the keeper to do that instead of the SHPO.
Right.
So it's a secondary avenue.
And you bring the keeper in when there's a...
When the SHPO refuses to
do it. Yeah, there's a disagreement to resolve those.
So I don't know. You could solve that by saying the applicable agency, provide recommendations to the applicable state or national agency.
I like the flexibility of that, too. Because if they change the federal law on us...
Yeah, or maybe it's multiple agencies sometimes, like you guys are mentioning.
Okay.
Do you think we should specify DAP and or just applicable agency?
I think applicable agencies covers it personally.
Yeah.
All right. Does that work for
everyone? Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
So we're adding language to D4F.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Because we're going to need this. Specify that, specify that language in the motion.
Yeah.
Okay.
You still have to open it for public hearing, too. Public testimony.
Yeah.
Just in case.
Okay. So, just before you get started, so just as I've said, this recommendation will go to the Planning Commission, who will review the code and what you have put forward and then give a recommendation to the council. So, two more steps.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if there's things, you know.
Any last questions for Jackie or Sharon?
Just kudos.
Yeah, it's been a long process. It's a lot of work.
I think it's going to be a lot better. So.
Big improvement.
Good work.
Okay, I'll open it up to public comment then if anybody has like to weigh in on county code for historic preservation.
Did the technocrats all go home? All the wonks are gone?
No, Holly's here. I wouldn't call her a wonk, but...
No, I have a public comment on something else.
Oh, okay. All right, well, I know you've been through this before, so I just wanted to give you an
option. I'm thrilled it's being updated and clarified. I think it's great.
Okay, great. No other public comments? All right. If there's no further public comment, then we will consider the hearing closed. And I'll open it up to the Commission for deliberation and entertain a motion when ready.
I don't have any other questions for staff or anything.
Or any other comments
or thorough, I think.
I just didn't take any notes, so I can't make a motion. You took some notes.
Okay. I did take some notes. So I will make a motion then to approve the changes to Historic Preservation Code for Clark County with the condition that Section B1, we maintain the comment about eligible to be listed, right? And then section D4F, I didn't write all that down. Maybe you can read it back for the
record.
Did I miss something?
Yes. So section B, we're keeping listed or eligible to be listed on B1.
Correct.
B2 and new B3, right? And we have new numbering for that section per the errata sheet.
Okay, so we'll restate it in each of those.
Okay.
Fair enough. So we'll keep eligible to be listed under B1, B2, and B3. And then could you please read back the language that we had decided to insert into D4F, unless I'm skipping anything?
D4F would read, review nominations to the National Register of Historic Places and provide recommendations to applicable agencies according to criteria in the Commission's rules of procedures.
Okay. Sounds good to me. Mm-hmm. So with those two conditions, I move that we approve the changes to historic preservation code.
Actually, you need to get a second on your motion.
I'm opening up for a second. I'm waiting for a second.
Oh, I second your motion.
Okay, I hear a second. Is there any additional discussion over this motion?
No.
All in favor of approving these changes to Historic Preservation Code for Clark County?
Aye.
Aye.
All right.
Thank you, guys.
Wow.
Good job, Jeff.
Good job.
Good job.
Good job.
All of you.
All of you.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay.
And lesson she learned at the Confederate marker. You can tell there were a couple of things in there. I don't know why she did that.
Okay. Great. Let's jump down to old business and updates. So the first one is the revitalized Washington debrief. And Alex, I think I'm going to call on you to debrief everybody on that. I've been talking enough here.
Well, everyone should go to Port Townsend, what a lovely little town. Yeah, it was really good. Conference is my first one, and found it pretty useful. Robert put together a really good PowerPoint presentation about our Jefferson Davis delisting, the Jefferson Davis Highway Marker delisting of the highlight of 2017.
Was it well attended?
It was, I'd say we had about 20 people there, and I think given that we were on the last day and like the last session spot, I think it was pretty well attended, and I got the feeling that it was well received and people were pretty interested in it. I think what it did was provide a case study. You know, a lot of those talks are sort of 20,000 foot elevation type talks, and this I think kind of got into a more nuts and bolts of how a Historic Preservation Commission works through a thorny issue. I mean, one of the talks that I went to was called Telling Difficult Stories, you know, so had a panel of folks talking about things like the Japanese internment camps and that kind of thing. And then I think this really provided process at the you know, state or local level of you know, sort of nuts and bolts procedures. And I think people got a lot out of it to the point where Kim Gant with DAP came up to us and was just like, that was perfect. Are you guys willing to do it again? I want you guys to come to the Certify Local Governments Conference and do it in front of all the CLGs in September.
Oh, cool.
So
what a nice compliment.
Yeah, it felt good. And, Mark was in quite a bit of pain all weekend, or week, I guess, during the conference. So he did not, but he did attend, but he didn't present with us. So Robert and I worked out our roles, and I think we played off each other well in terms of presenting. So, yeah, it was good. And I think we're both on board for doing it in September. She hasn't solidified any dates or anything yet, so it sounds...
Okay. Yeah, it was really good feedback. I was proud of that, because put a lot of work, a lot more work than I thought it was going to be to kind of prepare for it, but it went over really well, and Greg Griffiths, he there from DAP as well. He said we did a really good job of putting together the story and kind of the flow of it, and then kind of we separated it to where I kind of talked about, you know, the lead up and the controversy and how the HPC got involved based on Clark County UDC and so forth. And then Alex kind of took it over from there and provided, okay, so who are these people, the United Daughters of the Confederacy, and what is the Jefferson Davis Highway? So kind of provided more of the history to enrich the story. And then we kind of came back around to kind of the close. I had some embedded video from some of the news coverage that had taken place. So it worked really well, and it was great to get the positive feedback.
Next time, make sure the audio works a little better for the embedded videos. But
So looking forward to that. Mark was a real trooper, but I think the two-person format worked really well. So We need to kind of reach out to Kim and kind of decide if she wants us to add to it or if there's any part of that presentation that we should emphasize or de-emphasize. But yeah, I think it'll be good for September at the CLG meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And I had asked, I'm not sure, I think it was Jackie I had reached out to, and what is the CLG meeting? And I was confused because last year we had the camp mm-hmm. training in place of the CLG meeting, and then the CLG meeting was in Spokane, right?
Right, yeah, yeah. And we elected to wait because we're hoping it would come back yeah. west side.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's good. This is a good conference, I thought. Okay, let's move on. Open government training reminder.
I just wanted to, I think I'd sent the link out, so those of you who still need to complete it, you can just get that finished. We can cross you off the list, and for both the city and the county requires it. So that was just a little reminder.
Okay, perfect. 78th Street Heritage Farm update.
Okay, I'll be brief, and then I want Alex to give a little bit of update too. So on Thursday, we had the informational meeting for the preservation plan at the Heritage Farm team meeting. So the consultants from AECOM is who the county hired to help develop this plan. So they went out to the farm a couple Thursdays ago, a perfect sunny, beautiful day, and did their assessments of all seven contributing buildings on the property, took a look at the silo, and then also looking at the landscape in relation to the potential interpretive trail. So last Thursday, they went through what they were hoping to get from this group is feedback on any other observations that people that know these buildings have noticed. There was cracking, you know, how long have you seen this crack? Has it, you know, been the same stable for this period of time and things like that? But they were also trying to get feedback as to what the stakeholders that utilize the farm, the buildings, hope to maybe reuse for some of these buildings that are either storage or something else. So the admin building, we don't foresee anything huge changing there. It's used for WSU Extension offices. We were able to get into the whole building, which was cool when we went out there with them. But they looked at how that facade had changed. In the late 60s, they took down that front entrance. And, looking back at how that possibly, if, you know, the county so chose, could put it back. They went through the two buildings that were kind of closer to that main building, which is the milk building and the garage, which are in very pretty good shape, and trying to figure out if they could be potentially used for meeting spaces, which seems to be one of the main needs out there for a lot of the community groups, to use them as like classrooms or some kind of community meeting spaces. So looking at how that could happen. And then the buildings that are up on the main kind of first terrace there, hill, the bunkhouse, the machine shed, and the hog barn. So the hog barn and the bunkhouse are on stilts of bricks. There's no foundation. There never has been. They just never were built with that. And they were also both probably relocated as far as we know. So the bunkhouse is in really, really bad shape. It's in the worst. We couldn't even walk in there. It's just not safe to walk in. What they shared with us is that one of their recommendations are probably going to go to something like reconstruction of that building, salvaging what can be salvaged and reconstructing it, maybe back to where it was originally located, which is just a little bit further away where the well is. And we think that's probably why it had to move, because PUD had to put the well there. And the county parks, there's a new well or something that is coming where it's going to be kind of unsightly and be noticeable. And they're wondering whether they could maybe possibly reconstruct the bunkhouse that would hide this well. So these are just ideas that they're just trying to get feedback and looking into. So that was one thing. The Cobb Barn is right now used pretty much for storage of very light trays for harvest. So no harvest or anything of weight is put in there, just the trays that you carry stuff in. So it probably can be stabilized and still used as that function. And then the machine shed is more of an open building. And no one really had any ideas except for, you know, it stores machinery. But the consultants were, you know, kind of probing, well, you know, have you ever thought about it as more of an interpretive space or a public space? If you're going to have this trail, would it be a good opportunity to have interpretive information or machinery or historic or agricultural machinery in there that you could interpret? So kind of getting people to think about that. So this is kind of where we were. They're going to put everything together in their first draft and their first report. And we'll get that this end of this week. So I'll forward that on to you all for review. They're going to come back and do another presentation to that same farm team and stakeholders and whoever else. And I'll invite you all as well on their final findings and recommendations. So they've kind of put together this matrix of, you know, high priority, low priority, you know, really expensive, low-hanging fruit kind of thing, so that the county can kind of help prioritize what they can do immediately and what they need to start working on to get to its bigger ones. So it was interesting. I think we had 30 people or so in the room, and good conversation.
The council chair did mention, though, that they have invested quite a lot in this already in 2009, and there's no budget left to do anything more, because there are quite a lot of poor conditions that have been cropping up, things that were splitting, leaking, and
So they did like the new roof, and we did some ADA, and
we've
used a lot of grant funding to get some stuff done. So it's going to be looking at kind of that kind of creative, you know, partnerships to see what we can do to some of the projects that may be part of their findings. So more to come. So that's that. Any questions about that preservation plan? It's due back to in August for DAP for final. So they'll get this first draft and they'll give us comments. And
will they be coming before us at all in the process?
No, that's why I hope you guys can go to that August. I think it's the 16th. We had to limit their travel to keep the budget so that we could get as much as we could out of it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I'll get that date out to you all tomorrow so that you can plop it on your calendar. And if you're all there or a quorum, we just notice it as a special meeting, and we'll just let, you know, inform people that you're all there so that you can hear that presentation and participate as well.
You know, just chaperone us into separate sub-quorum groups.
You're not going to be making any decisions there. You're just listening and, you know, asking questions. So. Mm-hmm. Then I wanted to circle about last month. We had someone ask about the grave marker that was found at the cemetery, and I didn't have a good answer, so I wanted Alex to kind of go over that again, so that we all can say what
we have it on record.
Yeah, because she wanted to know whether or not we needed to somehow put something there that would
back in its place.
Yes.
So, during the monitoring of the fence installation, the monitor found a grave marker from 1911 or 15. That's what the patent date on the back of the marker says. It's a metal marker with a little, on the front, has a little placard holder on it. And I don't know, did you guys see it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So, it was found outside the platted boundaries of the cemetery, and our conclusion was that it's probably in secondary context. It's not in its original location marking a grave. We did not feel comfortable leaving it out there because we felt fairly certain that, you know, now that it's been uncovered and we were placing it on the ground surface, that it would probably walk off the site. So we collected it, and I turned it over to the Clark County Historical Museum on February 13th. And Brad, you took it in, right? And so it's there, and Brad and I had a discussion about, you know, its future, and it, if the poor farm did get some kind of display going, that it could, you know, it would probably make the most sense to return it to the poor farm. So that's its status right now, and I
think her concern was more about if there was an actual grave under there and it should be respected. You know, I think that was more of her concern.
Yeah.
Like we should mark that area somehow.
It seems like that's what the neighbors thought.
Yeah, I mean, it was downhill and into the wooded area, kind of where the cement foundation was of the, what was told to us might have been the dynamite storage shed. And like I say, it's outside the platted boundaries now. I mean, you know, poor farm cemeteries, poor, you know, I mean, historic cemeteries in general have a way of having graves outside the platted boundaries. So, particularly Potter's Fields and that kind of thing. So, we just can't say for certain.
You didn't find anything in there that would, you know.
Okay. No, I mean, he monitored the whole excavation in that place, and no, you know, bits of wood or bone or any funerary items or anything, casket, right? Nothing like that came up. So,
okay, thank you, appreciate
that.
And while we're talking about kind of grants and stuff, since preservation land is reminding me that we did submit the 2019 grant for Parkersville. And it's modified a bit from what we originally talked about. We chatted with DAP about it and Alex about, since there has been no, I guess, archaeological survey really done.
Nothing comprehensive
yeah.
to address the site.
So that's what we applied for, so that they can have a baseline of some kind of survey that's says something about that site, and then with an added kind of give some guidelines for kind of a management plan on what to do with the site from what they've gathered from the survey. So it's kind of like survey plus. It's not the cultural management plan that we were talking about originally, because we think we need to have that baseline.
They can build off of it.
Yes.
Yeah, springboard kind of thing. So
we let them know, and we hope that the consultant, whoever is hired, could, if that's a recommendation to do one of those, or if what's in the management or recommendations suffices for what the site needs. So.
Yeah, I mean, I can envision that, you know, if the survey is done well, then the recommendations would really be the building blocks of the cultural resource management plan.
We'll see. We'll find out this early summer, usually. Okay.
Great. And let's see. There's the SHPO Award.
Oh, yes.
That's in Olympia, and that's the 15th.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
And could you tell me again what time of day that is?
It starts at 1 o'clock.
Okay.
And Sarah knows you're going to be able to make it, right? Robert, mm-hmm. You had mentioned that you would like to do.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do something creative, like actually go stay the night and work that morning. So.
Well, just let us know. They wanted to know who was coming.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I'll be there, and I'm going to be bringing my coworker, because we're going to have a meeting in Olympia with, we're working too, so we're going to stop in Olympia, and then we'll go to this as well.
Oh, well, where is the award ceremony?
It's at their office.
Yeah.
I'll
send it back.
Okay,
yeah.
Which is one of those office buildings
yeah.
down there by the
mm-hmm.
Capitol.
Yes.
Okay, that's what I was thinking.
Is any of you three able to go? Or
unfortunately not.
Okay.
Mark has suggested.
Yeah, he might go too.
Yeah.
And to piggyback on that, the council, Clark County Council, wants to kind of give you some props too.
Right.
So
they were
scheduled something for May 22nd as a recognition of your award. So as many of you all that can come to that, that'd be great. It'll probably be at the beginning part of their meeting, which starts at 10 a.m.
And Sarah said she would go.
Yeah, I would encourage everybody.
Mm-hmm. What day?
22nd. It's the week following. Yeah.
10 a.m.
I'm trying to make that.
Wear your best Hawaiian shirt, and we'll get a picture.
this might be a silly question. Maybe I was. What are we receiving the DAP award for?
For preservation education. So
in reference to something specific.
Yeah. So it's kind of was a several elements of what you all have been doing the last couple of years. So the outreach to the cities and going out to visit all of the city councils and talking about the historic preservation program, the mobile app, the partnerships with the other historic organizations in the county, with the museum, the activity we did with the archaeological roadshow. So all of these things were part of the nomination that was submitted for it. So.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Congrats.
Mm-hmm. And then the one in Olympia is on the 15th.
Yes. That's all I have.
All right. And I'll open it up to public comment.
Just a reminder that if you haven't already done so, it'd be fantastic if you all go to the DAP website and fill out the survey about the State Historic Preservation Plan. There really will be people reading them and compiling the information. So answer questions, and of course, there's also room for additional comments. So share anything that you'd like to share. Really want to get a big turnout of folks responding to that. And it's not limited to people in this room. Anybody that you'd like to mention it to, we'd be greatly appreciative. Really, really want to get a lot of responses.
When's the deadline for that?
Well, there isn't actually a deadline right now. End of the summer, generally speaking.
Oh, okay.
But the sooner the better, because we're starting to write the plan. Mm. So we didn't want to cut off the comments because it's the kind of thing that sort of circulates around and there's word of mouth and you say, oh, I can do this, So we're trying to leave it open for quite a while. But so the sooner the better, but if you don't get around to it technically until later, it's going to be, your ideas will still be welcome and appreciated. And then just another reminder about the Washington Trust for Historic Preservation Youth Heritage Project. Once again, there's information about that on the Washington Trust website, preservewa.org. It opened high schoolers a free program to do some preservation learning up in the North Cascades this summer. Great opportunity, and hope if you know some kids or teachers, you might share the information with them, make sure they will learn more about it at the website.
Great.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Great. I just wanted to thank the commission for the support of the museum. I haven't had a chance to come in and thank you for what you've done for the first Thursday after hours talks that we're doing, and also just to let you know that we're having our talk in celebration of Preservation Month up at the North Clark Historical Museum this coming Thursday, and it really is thanks to your support that we're able to be up there and promote this other organization, and we've been really lucky in the local press to get a lot of great comments from the Columbian about museums partnering together, which is something that we haven't necessarily seen happen. And so we're really excited about that work here. We just wanted to stop by and let you guys know about that and say thank you for all that you're doing in the community, and thanks for continuing to support the museum.
Well, thanks, Brad. So that's this Thursday?
Yes, this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. up in Amboy. So it's out there.
Dark roads.
And so,
well, I'll be in Ellensburg, so
we can just show up and mingle. Then that's the idea.
Yeah, you show up, and then the talk will start at 6:30. And basically, we've asked the North Clark Museum to talk about the history of the building that they're in, the renovations, and we actually have used the graphic of the building before it was restored in the current building, and then about their current organization, and then myself and the North Clark people are going to make an appeal for people to support that museum that evening. So.
Great.
Cool. Especially today, you may have heard about the augmented reality app associated with the Providence Academy and Washington State University. Everything has been uploaded associated with that app to Apple. So if you have an iPad or an iPhone, you can actually download that app today. It's called PA Journey, as in Providence Academy Journey. There's a total of 12 episodes. We're not sure exactly why, but Apple has approved 10 of the 12 episodes, and so we're waiting for what they need on the other two episodes as part of the experience. But the volunteers actually at the Academy are there directly from 10 to 2 every day during the week, and we've got iPads at that building that can be checked out. And just frankly, a great opportunity to be able to experience the history of the Academy through kind of an augmented reality type of experience. It's incredible. There, frankly, there used to be to the east side of the Academy, a shrine that used to exist that actually came down during the Columbus Day storm. And it's actually been developed in like a 3D image. And so it'll all be rolled out here in the next month associated with that project. But we'd love to take you on a tour so you can kind of see that experience with the new technology. So it'll be a great tour.
When will it be available for Android?
What's that?
When will it be available for Android?
I don't know yet. It's interesting. You know, the WSUV students use this augmented reality platform that Apple's developed, and it was a great tool for these students to go through. I'm not sure that there will be the resources to transition that to other platforms, and so that's why we've tried to create a system to where people can visit the site and check out a tablet to be able to experience that. So.
Cool.
That's great. I spend a lot of my professional time studying augmented reality and the impact that it's going to have on the economy and the IT industry. So it's great stuff. Thanks.
Thank you.
Any other public comment? All right. Well, if there's no further public comment.
We got through all our business tonight.
Yeah, we did. This whole stack of papers.
Should we talk budgets?
Come on, Jackie.
I make a motion that we close the meeting. You were going to ask for that, weren't you?
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. Meeting adjourned.